You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with the June 28th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. While many Americans may not take President Trump seriously, others like Washington's key Gulf allies, the Saudis and United Arab Emirates, do. It was apparently the approving nods by Trump and his well-heeled son-in-law Jared Kushner toward 31-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, son of Saudi's aging King Salman, before and during Trump's visit to Riyadh last month that led the king to shuffle the line of succession to his throne by demoting his 57-year-old nephew Mohammed bin Nayef and promoting the younger Salman to crown prince, where he is now in line to succeed the king when he passes on. It is the younger bin Salman who, as the country's defense minister, launched a brutal air war in Yemen with the support of the Obama administration, and who apparently is behind the Saudis' efforts to isolate Qatar, its much smaller Sunni neighbor that has challenged Saudi Arabia for primacy in the Wahhabi Sunni world, and is currently home to the largest U.S. air base in the Middle East. The main allegation that the Saudis have made against Qatar is that it is funding terrorist organizations, among them the Saudis' one-time ally, the Muslim Brotherhood. That's true, of course, but for the Saudis, the original funders of al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the Afghan Mujahideen, to make that charge is the epitome of hypocrisy. As with its war on Yemen, things have not worked out in the manner that the Saudis had anticipated. Rather than isolating Qatar, it has brought it closer together with Shia Iran, with whom it shares the world's largest underwater gas field, and with Turkey, which also has an air base in the Gulf Kingdom. Both of those countries have been supplying food and other supplies to Qatar in helping it counter the Saudi blockade. It's just possible that Trump, in offering at first full-throated support for the Saudis' demands on Qatar, which includes shutting down of its TV station Al Jazeera, was not aware of the U.S. bases in that country. He has since tempered his tone to bring it closer to the efforts of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who hopes to mediate a peaceful resolution to that conflict. To sort all that out and to delve into the U.S. and British roles in creating the terror organizations whose actions have torn apart much of the world since 9/11, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with an expert on the subject, Dr. Christopher Davidson from Durham University in Northeast England. He's the author of a number of books on the region, including most recently Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East, which will be also the subject of our discussion. Well, in case you may not have noticed, the United States has started a war with Syria. It's undeclared, of course, as have been all the instances of U.S. aggression in foreign lands since our nation's founding. But what other explanation can one offer when an American fighter plane shoots down a Syrian fighter jet in Syrian airspace and President Trump's War Department claims it to have been an act of self-defense? It was just the latest attack on Syrian forces by the U.S. military, the most notable previously having taken place under President Obama last September, when just 2 days before Russian-American coordination in the fight against the terror groups in Syria was to begin, U.S. warplanes attacked a Syrian army convoy, killing more than 60 Syrian soldiers and wounding at least 120. American officials apologized for the mistake, but imagine what would have happened if the situation had been reversed. Well, Trump made his bones, as they say, by launching 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian Air Force base in April, supposedly in retaliation for what the president claimed, without proof, was a sarin gas attack by the Syrian Air Force on a Syrian town under the control of armed opponents of the government. On a previous program, I cited a former U.S. Army expert on the subject of chemical weapons who point by point took apart the administration's story. On Monday, as you may have heard, the White House announced it had information that the Syrians were planning to launch another chemical weapons attack, and Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, warned Syrian President Bashar Assad that if he, quote, conducts another mass murder attack using chemical weapons, he and his military will pay a heavy price, end quote. By an extraordinary coincidence, the White House statement came a day after an article appeared in the Sunday edition of Germany's Die Welt newspaper by veteran investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch. It challenged the Trump administration's version of events surrounding the April 4th chemical weapons attack on the northern Syrian town of Khan Shaykhun. Hirsch had to have it published in Germany when he couldn't find an American paper willing to print it. Subscribers to The New Yorker once could have expected to find his articles there, but for some years now, the esteemed literary magazine has been an apologist for America's never-ending wars. In his Die Welt article, Hirsch, drawing on inside sources, asserted that Trump was told that no evidence existed against the Syrian government, but that he ordered his generals to retaliate anyway. Marine General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and former Marine General, now War Secretary James Mattis, ordered the attacks while apparently aware that the reason given was Hirsch's sources called a fairy tale. Trump's National Security Advisor, Army General H.R. McMaster, furthered the deception with the help of a compliant mainstream media, which, as former CIA analyst Ray McGovern points out, broke from its current tradition of distrusting whatever Trump says in favor of its older tradition of favoring regime change in Syria and trusting pretty much whatever the rebels, so-called rebels, claim. According to Hirsch's sources, the normal deconfliction process was followed before the April 4 strike. In such procedures, U.S. and Russian officers have been supplying one another with advanced details of airstrikes, such as target coordinates, to avoid accidental confrontations among the warplanes crisscrossing Syria, a process that the Russians say they have halted as a result of the downing of the Syrian jet. Back in April, according to Hirsch, Russian Syrian Air Force officers gave details of the flight path to and from the Khan Shikun in English. The target was a two-story cinder block building in which senior leaders, high-value targets, of the two jihadist groups controlling the town were about to hold a meeting. Because of the perceived importance of the mission, the Russians took the unusual step of giving the Syrian Air Force a GPS-guided bomb to do the job. But the explosives were conventional, not chemical, according to Hirsch. The meeting place was on the floor above the basement of the building, where a source whom Hirsch described as, quote, a senior advisor of the U.S. Intelligence Committee community told him, quote, the basement was used as a storage for rockets, weapons, and ammunition, and also chlorine-based decontaminants for cleansing the bodies of the dead before burial. At the moment, the U.S. has a base in Syria that was established by Obama, and it is home to what was supposed to be a limit of 503 soldiers who the public was told would be advising and training Syrian troops opposed to the government as well as ISIS. In some areas, those groups were allied with Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate, which has operated under a number of names, among them the al-Nusra Front. In March, while there was an estimated 200 U.S. servicemen stationed in Syria, the administration announced that 400 more were on their way. That would exceed the stated limit, but Pentagon officials refused to make known the number who are actually there. That there is no legal basis under U.S. or international law for a single U.S. soldier being in Syria notwithstanding, they are ready for war. At the time, that's in March, General Joseph Votel, the head of the United States Central Command, told reporters that he was open to asking for more conventional military units if they are needed. I feel very comfortable with mixing special operations forces with conventional forces, General Votel said. That's the way we fight. Does anyone in or out of Congress care? Apparently not, since making war intervening in countries that have never attacked or posed a threat to us is as American as apple pie, with the exception of the period of time between the end of the Vietnam War and the beginning of the first Gulf War, during which Americans were suffering from what official Washington and the military considered a debilitating disease. They called it the Vietnam Syndrome. The word, as defined by Webster, refers to a group of signs and symptoms that occur together and characterize a particular abnormality or condition. Indeed, the American people were tired of war, and a way had to be found to either cure them of their tiredness or make them indifferent to America's imperial adventures. The secret was something the war makers had in their arsenal all along, the decision by President Nixon in 1971 to eliminate the draft. It seems to have worked. In the summer of 1973, following Nixon's re-election, members of Congress who watched Nixon escalate the Vietnam War without their approval passed the War Powers Act, which required a president who ordered U.S. troops into combat to come back to Congress within 60 days to get its approval to continue the operation. Obama ignored it, as no doubt will Trump. I bring this up because of some history every American should know. When the subject of a War Powers Act was first raised in the Senate in June 1969, Senator Everett Dirksen from Illinois, known then as Mr. Republican, entered into the congressional record a list of all the instances in which a U.S. president had ordered troops into action without consulting the Congress since the U.S. had become a nation. The list compiled at Dirksen's request by the Congressional Research Service indicated that in the 193 years since our nation had been founded, excluding the world wars which were declared by Congress, American presidents had ordered U.S. troops to intervene on foreign soil, which included those areas of the continent that had not yet been captured and inhabited by indigenous Native Americans, over 250 times, a number that has likely doubled since. Reading through the list, which contained the date and brief description of what U.S. troops had done, is a sobering experience and should be required of all Americans, at least reading in every public school. I couldn't put my hands on my copy as I prepared for today's program, but there's one entry that has stuck forever in my mind. It was in 1824 that sailors from U.S. naval vessel burned the village of Greytown on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast to the ground to avenge an insult by the mayor of the town to the ship's captain. I did not attend, nor admittedly have I read or heard much about a people summit that took place in Chicago on June 10th and 11th. But I suspected intuitively, based on what I haven't witnessed over the past decade, that in the call issued for this gathering that was attended by 4,000, there would be no mention of stopping U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, or addressing U.S. imperialism globally. This past weekend, I went online and read the call, and I'm truly sorry to say that I was right. Among the multitude of important domestic issues that the summit was to address, there was nary a word about resisting our enduring wars or the very real likelihood that another one is on its way. That I found to be unconscionable is neither here nor there. It is what it is, a sad commentary on who or on what we are as a country and a people at this moment in time. I would like to believe that this issue and its absence from the call were raised by some who attended. Finally, as there appears to be no let-up in the hysteria about Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 elections, and since the mainstream media and the New York Times in particular seem obsessed with finding a new way to degrade President Vladimir Putin and Russia virtually every day with stories that have nothing to do with the elections, it's worth taking a look at another election 20 years earlier in Russia, in which U.S. political operatives played a major and not-so-secret role. On July 15, 1996, the cover of Time magazine, which you could see online, featured a cartoonish Boris Yeltsin holding a U.S. flag with the headline, quote, "Yanks to the Rescue, the Secret Story How American Advisors Helped Yeltsin Win." It described how three Republican Party political professionals went over to Moscow and turned around Yeltsin's campaign when polls had his popularity rating at 6%. Their story was also featured on Nightline. The neocon organ, however, the Weekly Standard, strongly objected to that characterization, stating that to suggest American interference in the election was an insult to the Russian people. Quote, "They chose to downplay the greatest political event of the decade," wrote Stanford professor Michael McFaul, "the triumph of Democrats and democracy in the first direct election of a head of state in Russia in 1,000 years, and featured instead three American consultants who allegedly won the race for Boris Yeltsin," end quote. In the next sentence, however, McFaul begins to give the game away, suggesting that to give the credit to the three U.S. operatives is to, quote, "taint the legitimate achievement of Americans who have lived and worked in Russia for years to strengthen that country's nascent democratic institutions," end quote. Well, we have to read further in the article to find out what Americans he is referring to. "The Americans," McFaul wrote, meaning those mentioned in the Time article, "also claim that their initial task was simple education, campaigning 101, implying that their colleagues knew nothing about campaign tactics. This comment is at best naive and at worst insulting," said McFaul. Dozens of people working in Yeltsin's campaign had been through Campaigning 101 well before the American, quote, teachers ever set foot in Russia. Since 1990, McFaul trumpeted, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute have conducted hundreds of seminars, conferences, and exchanges on party organization, message development, focus groups, polling methods, television ads, and so on. And a think tank translated into Russian the coveted Republican National Committee Campaign Handbook, mentioned by Nightline as an election Bible, 4 years before these Americans arrived, these other Americans arrived. So we must conclude it wasn't those three Americans that Time and Nightline publicized who should be credited for Yeltsin's victory, but other American operatives who had been working in Russia far longer. It should be noted that the National Democratic Committee, National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute are components of the National Endowment for Democracy, a quote-unquote nonprofit agency that's funded by Congress under the Agency for International Development and thus can be considered part of the U.S. government. From its record, it can be said the National Endowment is its name, regime change is its game. It has been headed since its founding in 1983 by neocon Carl Gershman and featured on its board as none other than fellow neocon Elliot Abrams, whose qualification for the position was apparently he's illegally providing weapons for the Contras in their efforts to overthrow the legitimate government of Nicaragua, for which he was indicted, then later pardoned by the senior George Bush. As you may have guessed, the National Endowment was on the scene before the coup in Ukraine. It stated in its resource summary for fiscal year 2013, the year before the coup, that, quote, the objective of the endowment in most of the countries where it is active in the Europe region is helping new democracies to succeed. For Eastern and Southeastern Europe, this goal is best met through these countries' accession to the European Union and to NATO, end quote. In the same paragraph, it listed Ukraine as its first priority in Europe. What is quite amazing is that the National Endowment was functioning in Russia a year after the Ukraine coup, but in July of 2015, it became the first so-called NGO to be booted out of the country as an undesirable. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوز قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning you will hear Israeli historian Ion Pape's speech at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs titled Decolonizing Israel. Here is Dale Sprusansky introducing Ion Pape to the conference.
For our final keynote, it's a man that is well known to all of you, Ion Pape. And as Hanan Ashrawi mentioned earlier today, in an age of alternative facts, I think we can all agree on the importance of being able to discern truth from fiction. While alternative facts may be a new term in American politics, the idea behind it is far from original. As we all know, for decades, colonial powers have developed and propagated false narratives to legitimize the subjugation of indigenous peoples. Like colonists before them, Israel has relied on alt history, a false or distorted account of history, to justify its policies towards the Palestinians. If the so-called conflict is ever going to be resolved, the events that led to the creation of Israel, namely the Nakba, must be reckoned with. This reality, that an honest understanding of the past is necessary to pave a better tomorrow, is the reason we invited historian Ilan Pappe to today's conference. Ilan Pappe has written prolifically and with honesty and courage on the history of Israel and the events that facilitated its creation. His 2006 book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, with its painfully honest title, created controversy, but is nonetheless a seminal book on this issue. Professor Pappe chose the title knowing that it would be provocative, but that it was also true to the research presented in his book. As I told him at dinner last night, one can say that in choosing the title, Professor Pappe was being more timeless than timely. As I'm sure as the West can slowly comes to better grips with the reckoning of the history of Israel, future generations will find the title of his book progressively less controversial, at least I hope. Ethnic Cleansing, of course, is just one of many books Professor Pappe has written. He has an upcoming book entitled 10 Myths About Israel, which will be released shortly and will surely be a valuable resource to those looking for a critical and honest assessment of pro-Israel narratives. Professor Pappe is currently professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. He was born in Haifa, and prior to coming to the UK, he was a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Haifa. His keynote today will focus on how an honest assessment of history is necessary in order to resolve the seemingly intractable conflict. Professor Pappe.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here, and thank you for the warm and empowering reception. I told my dear friend Clayton that we have traveled further than anyone else. For me, it's midnight. For him, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And yet we were put at the end of the conference, and we wondered what was the hidden agenda. Either they thought we can wake you up after a very long and exhaustive day, or they thought that you are sleepy anyway, so you won't notice the provocations that both of us are going to present to you. So we'll see which one of the two narratives is valid. Bill Quandt, in a series of articles in the Journal of Palestine Studies, very cleverly charted what makes an American president's legacy about Israel and Palestine valid. And he pointed to three major factors that inform such a legacy. One is the personality of the president. The second one are the lobbies, and by the lobbies he meant both the Israeli AIPAC lobby, both AIPAC and the Christian Zionist lobbies. And the third group, he called them the professionals, the people who work in the State Department, in the National Security Council, in the intelligence community, and who are there not necessarily just because of their political affiliation to the presidency, but also because, at least allegedly, because of their professionalism. Yeah, thank you. He concluded, and I think he's right, that the president's personality, although it is very important, and I don't have to tell you this today, he wrote it before he thought that personality could be that important in a president. But he concluded that the personality of the president did not have a huge impact on American policy towards the Palestine question. It did have some impact, but not a fundamental impact. He did agree with everyone who spoke before me that the Israeli lobby had a huge impact on American policy towards Israel and Palestine, but also tended to grant or credit the professionals with an equal impact on American policy towards the Israel-Palestine question. And I would like really to focus on that third group, because everyone else was talking about the lobby, and I don't need to repeat the wise words that were already said. In fact, what I'm going to argue today, this afternoon, is that as much as the lobbies are important in affecting and influencing American policy, there is a basic and fundamental misunderstanding of what the conflict in Palestine is all about, including among those American diplomats, pundits, politicians who see themselves champions of Palestinian rights. The level of, I wouldn't call it ignorance, because these are very educated, well-read people, so ignorance would not be a fair concept here. The level of blindness, or the level of ignorance in the sense of ignoring certain chapters rather than not being able to understand reality, this level is so high that it really makes it impossible, even when you have a period in which the lobbies are not strong, or even when you have a president who is more pro-Palestinian than anyone before him, the level, the depths of that ignorance is so significant that it would not allow the two other factors, even if they are diminished or weakened, to influence fundamentally the American policy and, in association, the reality on the ground. Now, what is missing? And this is what I would like to point out. What is missing is an understanding of the nature of Zionism, the nature of the Zionist project in Palestine, not as a nostalgic journey into the past, but as a current analysis. The late and amazing scholar of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, said famously that settler colonialism is not an event, it's a structure. Zionism is not an event, it's a structure, and it is a settler colonialist structure. It was a settler colonialist structure in 1882, and it is a settler colonialist structure in 2017. And you don't appease a settler colonialist project by dividing Palestine into two states. That will never appease the settler colonialist project. The only way to challenge a settler colonialist project is to decolonize the settler colonialist project. And this challenge has not been digested by American policymakers, including those who regard themselves as open-minded, balanced, if you want, objective about the situation. Because, and I don't blame them, because to talk about decolonization in the 21st century is abnormal. Colonialism, in our mind, belongs to the 19th century. Decolonization belongs to the first half of the 20th century. But in the 21st century, if we will not resell or return to these fundamental concepts of colonialism and decolonization, we will not move forward towards a solution in Israel and Palestine. I will give few examples of how the narrative, the discourse, the conceptual framework of settler colonialism can lead us to a different view on the reality today, not just about the reality in the past. I will begin with something that even here, I think, is sometimes accepted, maybe not intentionally, maybe unconsciously, but is part of the American heritage of dealing with conflicts such as Israel and Palestine. And this is the idea that in Palestine you have a conflict between two national movements. And then everything else comes out of this analysis. If these are two national movements, we have to satisfy both of them. We have to divide the land between both of them. They share responsibility for the conflict equally. We should find a way of satisfying their aspiration equally. Now, it doesn't matter, of course, that when you translate this paradigm of parity to a percentage of territory or demography, of course, it was never suggested by any mediator, whether they were Americans or non-Americans, that the land would be divided 50-50. That was never on the cards. But even the idea of 22 and 78 or the 55 and 45 of 1947 was based on this false analysis that what you have in Palestine is a genuine struggle between two national movements. Zionism is not a national movement. It's a settler colonialist movement. And the Palestinians, before they become a nation, they are first and foremost the native indigenous people of Palestine, who sometimes chose nationalism as the best vehicle to defend their native indigenous rights, and probably would have to find a different vehicle in the 21st century to protect their rights, much more an agenda of human rights and civil rights than national rights, because the national rights have been understood in the world as a wish to have a small Bantustan next to Israel, and this is not going to work. Another point which is important when you use the settler colonial perspective on the situation in Israel and Palestine. A basic American assumption, and not just an American assumption, a United Nations assumption, in fact an international assumption, is that the conflict in many ways began in 1967. Not because people don't know what happened before 1967, but because in 1948, the international community, through the United Nations, legitimized the idea of a Jewish state over 78% of Palestine. So even Palestine's friends advised the Palestinians not to bring the future of the 78% of Palestine, namely Israel, into the negotiation. The best, they were told, you can hope for, is to have a state over 22% of Palestine. Now, this idea that because the United Nations legitimized a state, which is, of course, an important fact, which we should never ignore, but this idea, of course, brings us to a narrative of why there is a conflict which has little relevance or connection to the reality on the ground. The conflict did not start in 1967. And the reason that there is still a conflict today is not because of the events of 1967. In fact, our historical research these days shows something many of us who lived in Israel knew anyway, but it was always good to corroborate this by new documentations and archives, that Israel planned the occupation of the West Bank long before 1967. In fact, from a Zionist perspective, it made no sense whether you were on the left in the Zionist movement or the right of the Zionist movement. It made no sense whatsoever to allow the Transjordanians, namely the Jordanians, to annex the West Bank while the Zionist movement had the military power to take it over. The reason they allowed the Jordanians to annex the West Bank was because they wanted to neutralize the Arab Legion in the 48 wars so that the most efficient Arab army would not be part of the all-Arab coalition that was supposed to save Palestine from the Zionist conquest. But in any case, many among the Israeli generals and politicians regretted that decision. And from 1948 onwards, created a lobby that pushed the Israeli government to seek the opportunity to occupy the West Bank. In fact, since 1963, and a book of mine on this will come out in the summer called The Biggest Prison on Earth. Since 1963, the Israelis systematically and methodically prepared the occupation of the West Bank. And Gamal Abdel Nasser provided them the opportunity that they were looking for in June 1967. And the Israelis were very well prepared for taking over the West Bank. They already had a military rule imposed on the Palestinian citizens in Israel. And all they had to do was transmit this military rule from Israel itself and impose it on another group of Palestinians. But maybe even more important, if you understand Zionism as settler colonialism and Israel as a settler colonial state, you understand that any depiction of the Israeli society as being torn between two camps, a liberal camp that wants to withdraw from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and believes in a two-state solution, and an intransigent, inflexible camp, a war camp that does not want to give up the territories, that this depiction is true only as far as the general public is concerned, but is not relevant to the DNA of the Israeli political, military, and strategic elite. They are united, and they were united since 1967, in their determination to do all they can to keep the West Bank as part of Israel and find ways of not incorporating the population that lives there. And they had a similar strategy towards the Gaza Strip as well. The peace process was not born in Washington. It was born in Tel Aviv as means of creating this charade of an internal Israeli debate that brings hope for anyone who believes that these two national movements could be coached through the intervention of a mature mediator into a reasonable peace treaty, one that you can easily find in a textbook in the political science departments in American University, which is drawn from the world of business, where, as Madeleine Albright used to put it, everything visible can be divisible. So you divide land, demography, and she warned us when she was the Secretary of State that everything which is invisible is indivisible. Namely, don't talk about justice, morality, the refugee problem, the nature of Zionism, and the nature of the State of Israel, because there's nothing we who learned this in the departments of business and political science can offer in front of such realities. So, what can be done in order to move forward the discussion so as that the mismatch between the discourse that we have been using for years about the conflict, its origin, its nature, the reasons for its continuation, how do we move from this mismatch to a conversation, at least a conversation, that is far more relevant to the reality on the ground? And every passing day, with these unilateral Israeli policies on the ground, you don't even need to talk to people about settler colonialism, because the one Israeli state is already there. The one apartheid state of Israel came into being around 2001, but maybe we haven't noticed that. But it's there. It is there, and it's going to be more and more legalized as an apartheid state with every passing day. And we will continue to talk, if we will continue to talk about a two-state solution, if we will continue to talk on the basis of the assumptions of the previous peace process, there is nothing we could do to change that reality in which 6 million Palestinians would continue to live under an oppressive regime in various forms. So what can we do? One thing I think, and I know it's difficult for some people, is to realize that the two-state solution is dead. Many of us still sleep with the two-state solution, but you're sleeping with a corpse. Many of us still dine with the two-state solution, but you're sleeping with a dead body. It's time to go to the morgue together and watch together the corpse of the two-state solution, and hopefully we will all be invited to the funeral so that we can get over it and move on. Secondly, and not less importantly, we should understand that decolonization is not a process that can be forced from the outside. What you can force from the outside is the end of occupation, the end of oppression, the end of the atrocities that are done in the name of apartheid. But you cannot force reconciliation between the settlers and the natives from the outside. But as long as you are not sending the message, as we did send the message to apartheid South Africa, that the end of apartheid is a precondition for a process of reconciliation, whereas in Palestine we always said reconciliation first and then the end of apartheid. As long as we don't send this message, either as a civil society or as a political and intellectual elite, we will continue to have this mismatch between the way we talk about the reality and the way the reality unfolds on the ground. And I think this clearer division of labor between the outside and the inside, from the perspective of decolonization, not from the perspective of a peace process, from the perspective of decolonization, is very urgent, has to be urgently adopted by any one of us who is either a student of the conflict or is involved in it or is interested in it or wants to show solidarity with its victims. Because if we in the universities, in the press, in the political arena, if we will not use the right dictionary and the right language to describe what goes on the ground, then we will continue to provide an umbrella of immunity to the settler colonial state of Israel to try and complete what it started in 1948, namely to have as much of Palestine as possible with as few Palestinians in it as possible. And believe me, I know what I'm talking about. I was born in Israel in 1954. I'm a product of the Israeli educational system, probably not a very good product of the Israeli educational system, quite a flawed product of that system. But there's sometimes someone who was part of that system, who was indoctrinated in this system, when you hear the discourse abroad about the possibilities that are open in the Jewish society for change, when you hear that there is a two-state solution around the corner somewhere in the globe, you find it very frustrating because in your daily experience, you know how far away from the realities is this conversation. Now, analyzing correctly does not mean that there will be an easy ride forward, and I'm finishing. analyzing or having the right analysis doesn't mean that the prognosis would be easy. I'm not going to say here that the move into decolonization, into probably the path on a one-state solution with various models that are possible, is an easy journey. It is as difficult as any journey we had to take as a human society when we faced an indoctrinated, racist society that has to be deprogrammed, has to be decolonized in the mind before we can decolonize it on the ground. The only thing I'm saying is that for 50 years now, we didn't even try to do that because we claimed that the only urgent need we had was to convince the Israeli society to give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and then we can lead to the path towards reconciliation and peace. Well, this was a waste of time. This was a waste of energy. 50 years are a lot of time in a peace process that was based on the wrong assumptions and had reaped the bitter fruits that anyone with his eyes in his head could have seen were the only possible consequence of such a misconception and misunderstanding of what the conflict is about. Finally, I would say this. Nothing of what I said can at all be materialize without, of course, a new unification of the Palestinian political scene. We need a different Palestinian thinking. We need a united, authentic representation of the Palestinian people, which we don't have today, that should give us the lead. We will have to get rid eventually of the existing political structures in Palestine. in order to be able to lead us, settlers and natives, together into a future that has normal life in it, as you and other people in the world enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So most of the questions here revolve around one point here, and that's what exactly a one-state solution would look like. So one person asks, what happens to the Palestinians? Another asks, how do Israelis, settlers, Palestinians, refugees coexist? What happens in that first day, week, year, decade?
Right. Yes. Well, building a different political structure from the one you have is a long journey. And any attempt to answer all these questions would be wrong because, first of all, as I said, you have to remove the one conversation that does not allow you to invest the same energy as you've invested in the last 50 years in the wrong solution. So I would put it, I would say this, two points about this. One is, as I think there is already a one-state solution, we don't need to build a one-state solution. What we need is to change the regime of that one state. We need to make it a democracy, because now it is not a democracy. Now, you build it by a slow movement from below and not by big revolutions, as the Arab world has learned, unfortunately and painfully, in the last 6 or 7 years. It is time, I think, for academics, pundits, and people who have the time and the energy to try and begin to build models of a joint curriculum, a joint judicial system, a joint political solutions for questions of symbolism, such as names, the identity of the state, and so on. I don't think it's time for a political movement to do it as yet. It's too premature. I'm just saying we have to start this conversation. And there are more and more movements from below that define themselves as a one-state movements. We talked about the BDS a lot today, but there's also an ODS, the One Democratic State Movement, from below. Now, these group of people, whether they are activists, whether they come from different walks of life, begin to give answers to the question that you are asking. But I think more than anything else, I'm always surprised when I'm sort of listening to John Kerry, re-listening to John Kerry's last speech. If you remember, he was in a very dramatic voice. He explained to us that without a two-state solution, the only possible scenario is an apartheid Israel. And I wanted to say, hello, John. How are you? Looking up. The one-state apartheid is already there, so your warning is not about the future. You're actually describing the present. Secondly, couldn't you find one moment in your speech, maybe two sentences in your speech, to say that actually having a democratic state for Jews and Palestinians between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean is not a doomsday scenario? Couldn't you just say, wouldn't it be wonderful to have settlers and natives living as equal citizens in the same state? Why do you have to describe this as a doomsday scenario? The only people in the world who would describe this as a doomsday scenario are Zionists. Because they think that when the Jews are not a majority, the only possible thing that Palestinians can do is to kill them. Well, I lived in Haifa all my life. I live in the Galilee. I was in political outfits and academic outfits where the Jews were the minority, and nothing bad happened to us. And the idea that Palestine cannot be a political outfit if the Palestinians are the majority and the Jews are a minority is a racist idea that should be challenged strongly.
So a question about the role of the Palestinian Authority in an official rather than a de facto one state. How would the Palestinian Authority go about disbanding, and what would that look like?
Right. Well, I think anyway Israel is going to eventually disband the PA, so it's not my agenda. I'm not a prophet. I don't know exactly how it will unfold, but I have no doubt that the way Israeli politics is going and the way American politics is going and the level of the decreasing level of interest in the international community about Israel and Palestine, given all these factors, I have very little doubt that there will be a moment where the reality that already unfolded, namely that Israel controls the West Bank, and in many ways controls the Gaza Strip, despite of what the Hamas may feel, that this de facto reality would be declared as a de jure reality. There's one interesting and significant development in the West Bank that people have not noticed. In the last few months, Israel has removed half of the checkpoints in the West Bank. So when I noticed that, I said, is it because an American president is coming? Because the last time they did it was before Obama's visit, and then they returned the checkpoints 2 days after he left. No. They have removed most of the checkpoints from Area C because they regard Area C, which is 55% of the West Bank, as part of Israel. And they don't want Israelis to move around a state which has checkpoints. It doesn't look nice. It doesn't feel nice. So the checkpoints are only in Area A and B and between Area A and B and C. Now, the next step is to do the same for Area B. Maybe Area A would remain, Greater Ramallah, as a Palestinian enclave. I doubt whether at that moment in time there would be enough Palestinians to say this is what we were fighting for, a nation state in Area A. I'm very blunt with you because I think I don't want to spend another wasteful year of talking the wrong language about a reality that I know very well, and this language has nothing to do with that reality. So it's not a matter of saying the PA should go or shouldn't go. The PA belongs to a narrative and a story that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground. And that story is going to change. In fact, it's already changing. It's just a matter when people are willing to use the right words to describe a reality that they don't like for various reasons to acknowledge.
Couple of questions about BDS. One person asks, which is that BDS is the only way to achieve decolonization, and what are the possible outcomes of the movement?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we shouldn't do is confuse BDS with a vision. We need the Palestinians to redefine what the liberation of Palestine means in the 21st century. We cannot rely on nostalgic ideas of the 1960s. Neither do I think the political Islamic movements have a vision that is going to work. So we need a redefinition of the Palestinian liberation project. And sometimes people, I think, confuse the means, which is the BDS, with the need to rethink the vision, the project of liberation. Now, however, as I said before, the outside world cannot be indifferent to the suffering of the people just because we are in this limbo between a project, the two-state solution, that is irrelevant, is not going to work, and as I said, is in the morgue for a few years, but we haven't noticed, and a new project which will take quite a while to build because we need a unification of the Palestinian side, we need a more authentic representation. We need a lot of things to happen for us to be on the road towards this new vision. But we don't have the luxury of remain idle and indifferent while the clock of destruction, which is faster than the clock of reconstruction, is working. And therefore, the BDS is so important. Because the BDS is there to say, Yes, there is a void of leadership. Yes, there is a chaotic moment in history where there is no peace process and there's no alternative to that peace process. But that doesn't mean that we as an international community have nothing to do and can do nothing in order to stop the suffering of the people on the ground. And the greatest thing about the BDS was that it introduced to us again the two groups that the Oslo process brutally excluded from the future of Palestine, the Palestinian refugees and the Palestinian minority in Israel. And we should be thankful to the BDS for reminding us that the people of the West Bank and the people of the Gaza Strip are only half of the Palestinian people, and that these two territories are only 22% of Palestine. And you don't cure an illness by dealing with the hand if the whole body is ill.
So earlier today in his keynote, Mearsheimer suggested that idea of a expulsion is unlikely. But lots of people here seem to be worried about it because I'm getting lots of questions about this. So one person asks, what exactly is stopping another mass expulsion? One person says Netanyahu realizes the two-state solution is dead but doesn't want one state with Palestinians. So how, you know, what's stopping him from trying that again as the 48?
I think John is right in the sense that it's difficult to envisage an ethnic cleansing on the scale that Israel committed in 1948, expelling half of Palestine's population, demolishing half of Palestine's villages, and destroying almost all the Palestinian towns apart from Nazareth. Yes, I agree, this is difficult. But I think what is important to understand that ethnic cleansing is a paradigm as much as settler colonialism is. And the Israelis perfected the notion of ethnic cleansing and adapted it to the 21st century much better than any other political movement that I know in history. For instance, they found out that actually you can achieve the same goal of having a space without the people in it by not allowing people to leave the place in which they live. You don't have to expel people from villages. You can enclave them. You can siege them in villages, and you get the same result. Namely, you don't have demographically to include the enclave, imprisoned, incarcerated people in your demographic balance, which is the most important thing for a settler colonial state. And even liberal people around the world somehow agree that Israel has the right to talk in these racist terms as if this is acceptable. So you don't need massive expulsion in order to annex Area C, for instance. You can, and they're already doing it. I don't know how many of you have been to Anata, how many of you have been to the Shuafat refugee camp, how many of you have been to Tulkarem, a whole town that is surrounded by a fence with one gate to the town in the hands of the Israeli soldiers. It's a big jail. And the only reason people are incarcerated in this jail is because they are Palestinians, for no other crime. Now, this is the model Israelis of the left like, because they are against expulsion. They are against expulsion. They say expulsion is an Israeli right-wing notion. Our notion is separation, or as they call it in Hebrew, hafrada, which means in English apartheid. Hafrada, segregation, in more literally. We really believe that it's much better for the Palestinians to be incarcerated, enclaved in homogenic Palestinian areas. They don't even need green lungs, the Palestinians, because they're not a Western modernized society. And we can keep it forever like this, because we have hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are part of the police state that manages, this is not an occupation, that manages the colonization of Palestine, whether it is in the Nakab, in the Galilee, in the Gaza Strip, or in the West Bank. So this, there's no need for mass expulsion. You have built an amazingly big apparatus that so many Israelis are involved in, that you have the manpower to police daily the control over 6 million Palestinians within the one state that you have created 15, 16 years ago, and still even sell this to the world as a democracy that unfortunately had to occupy a certain area, but of course is just looking for the right Palestinian partner to get it back to them. We are still hearing this bullshit today. Unbelievably. Thank you.
Question about terminology here. One person says, why didn't you choose to label the Palestinian suffering as genocide instead of ethnic cleansing? And this person contends that Palestine is the classic example of the UN's definition of genocide.
Because I think there is a difference between genocide and ethnic cleansing. I did use the term genocide for Gaza. I called it incremental genocide, and this was reiterated by the United Nations report last year that talked about the de-development of Gaza in 2020, which means the Gaza Strip is under such circumstances that massive death of people and young people is inevitable. So it becomes an incremental genocide. But for me, genocide is also a term that talks about intention and ideology and racism. Now, there is kind of in between, but that's a bit too scholarly, and I don't like to use it in a world of activism, but I'll do this. There is something in between the term of genocide and ethnic cleansing that, again, if I'll refer to Patrick Wolf, who I mentioned before. Patrick Wolf is, for those of you who haven't read his work, I really recommend this. He has an amazing article called The Logic of the Annihilation of the Native. Maybe I'm a bit, as I said, it's 2 o'clock in the morning for me, so maybe it's not annihilation. Where's Andrew? Andrew, are you there? The elimination. I knew it was wrong. Thank you. He's my student, so he knows he has to be awake and answer these questions even at midnight if I ask him. Okay. Yeah. So the title is The Logic of the Elimination of the Native. And he refers to all the settler colonial societies, including in this country, in the south of America, in Australia, New Zealand, and so on, in which he explains quite simply and very convincingly that the people who escaped or fled from Europe in the last 3 or 4 centuries because of all kinds of persecutions and looked for a new homeland encountered native populations that they believed they had to eliminate for the success of building this new homeland. Here, it resulted in genocide. The same happened north of the border and south of the border. Also in Australia, it ended in genocide. In South Africa, in Palestine, in Algeria, the methods of eliminating the native as an obstacle for creating the new homeland was not genocidal. But it was bad enough. It was bad enough. So, yes, you can talk about the elimination of the Palestinians as a natural consequence of the logic of Zionism of all its shades and colors. However, elimination in the 21st century with international focus on human rights and civil rights, with the internal wish of the Israelis to be part of the democratic world, and maybe even genuine Israeli impulses of democracy, elimination becomes something far more complex than what I associate with genocide. And in fact, we saw the need for an accurate conversation when the terrible events unfolded in Syria in 2011. We, as activists on behalf of Palestine in the West, struggled to keep Palestine as an issue when people said to us, but how can you compare what happens to the Palestinians with what happens in Iraq, what happens in Syria? And we were trying to say, yes, but you know, we are talking about the same brutality, the same inhumanity, but we're talking about a span of 100 years, not of 4 or 5 years. And this incremental inhumanity happens every day. And when it happens on a daily basis, it's not very dramatic. It doesn't catch the media's attention. And you can put it aside compared to the huge massacres and horrible things that are happening in Syria and Iraq. And this is where the idea of settler colonialism as a structure is so important. And this is why it's not necessary to talk about genocide as much as it is necessary to say that the DNA of the settler colonial state of Israel is to continue the project, as I put it in simple terms, of having as much of Palestine with as few Palestinians in it. Now, they have the whole of Palestine. In the last 50 years, they don't have a geographical ambition anymore. Israelis of all kinds do not want to occupy Lebanon, Jordan, or Egypt. They are satisfied with the borders that they have today. They have a demographic issue, not a geographical issue. And when they deal with a demographic issue, they found a formula that one should say is working, unfortunately. And that formula says you can police 6 million Palestinians and still the world will believe you that this is a temporary oppression. And still the world will believe you that you will stop this oppression once peace will arrive. And you still can convince the world that you are the only democracy in the Middle East and the oppression of 6 million people is not a relevant item when you analyze the country as a democratic state. This is the importance of analyzing what's happening in Israel as a settler colonialism that can sometimes result to genocide, sometimes results to ethnic cleansing, and quite often results to a charade of peace that provides it a shield of immunity from any genuine rebuke and condemnation in the global community.
You have been listening to Israeli historian Ilan Pappe speaking at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
I assure you, no matter what significance you may hold for me, to the village and its committee, you are merely citizen number 6 who has to be tolerated, and if necessary, shaped to fit.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Most of World War II's nuclear scientists were from Germany and Eastern Europe. So did Hitler test a nuclear weapon 8 months before the Allies? An intelligence report made public for the first time this year reveals evidence the Nazis may well have successfully tested an atomic bomb roughly 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July, 1945. Two Luftwaffe staff and a delegate from Italy describe seeing Hitler's mushroom cloud near the North German city of Lübeck early in October 1944. Also in his book Critical Mass, US writer Carter Heydrich looks at a shipment of Nazi-enriched uranium needed to build the atom bomb, which was shipped off at the end of the war to Japan, but eventually ended up in the hands of the Americans. Plus, hate preacher Tommy Robinson, another British-based Jewish group, Jewish Voice, has condemned him this week for inflaming hatred against Muslims, the same way as Hitler scapegoated the Jews. But how come the police protect his freedom of speech? And what about the far-right factories that foster this racial hatred? The so-called far-right incubator groups. We have a chat to former US Naval Intelligence Officer, Agent Kenyon Gibson, who infiltrated some of these London fascist groups. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Kaupner Wolf has a charity, 91 Ways, which brings together Bristol's ethnic groups around the meal table. and our taxes funding Bristol charity Happy Cities. How would you feel if you're about to be evicted? That it's your fault. You're just not happy enough. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. And if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But I'm joined on the line now by Carter Heidrick, who wrote that book Critical Mass back in the 1990s. Hi, Carter, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thanks for welcoming me, Tony. I appreciate the opportunity.
Could you just give us an idea of what first put you on the scent of this submarine? It was a Nazi submarine that left right at the end of the Second World War, but it was initially heading for Japan. It ended up in the United States with a cargo, we believe, of enriched uranium on board. But what first alerted you to this?
I actually started my professional career in the film business. I spent 10 years as a freelance filmmaker, writer, director, doing lots of things. One of the producers I had worked with knew I liked history and introduced me to an old German gentleman who had been in the German Third Army that was surrounded by Stalingrad. He was one of the nearly 5,000 survivors out of 335,000 that were taken prisoner or killed. And we had an interesting discussion. He had found a couple of, I won't go into the background of why he was looking, but his family was asking for reasons why he did what he did. And so he went searching for stuff, and he came up with a couple of documents. Kind of one of them said that there was uranium on a U-boat that was surrendered to the United States, and the other one said that Martin Bormann was tied to that U-boat. And that's really all he really had. And they said, this proves that the Germans made an atomic bomb and that the United States stole it from them, and that's what we used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And my response was, at that time, the Manhattan Project history was really kind of indelibly etched and still is, you know, the primary history of the birth of the nuclear age. And my response was, well, we got two problems here. Well, we got three problems. First problem is this is really recent history, so it's pretty new and prevalent. Second one is just by nature of its technicality, its scientific nature, it's probably the most documented piece of history ever. And the third one is you've only got two documents and you're not going to be able to change, you know, what is written and endeared to so many people, including me at the time, frankly. And my response at that point was, you know, I don't think you have anything here. Where there's smoke, there may not be fire, but we ought to at least look and see what's causing the smoke. And before we make the film, because when we make a film, it'll never be, if it is true, it'll never be proven with the film. It'll actually debase the argument because of the artistic license it's taken in feature films. So I said, you know, let me do a little check and see what's here. If there's nothing, we'll go ahead and make a fun fiction film. And if there is, then this really needs to be put in a book and fairly documented and put up for critical review so it can be established as the real history. So that's how I got into it.
Now, this U-boat was it's a bit weird because the enriched uranium is called U-235, but the U-boat is called U-234, U for U-boat or U for uranium. And apparently it docked at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in Maine on the 19th of May 1945, just after the end of the war in Europe, just a couple of weeks after, with 560 kilograms of U-235. You discovered evidence of an alleged synthetic rubber plant, I understand, as well at Auschwitz, that devoured more electricity than the city of Berlin, but it never produced any synthetic rubber. So did you dig up any evidence that the Nazis had actually been enriching uranium?
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of evidence that they had been enriching it. The key ones are that, let me back up a step, there's two ways to make an atomic bomb. One is with uranium, the other is with plutonium. And the Nazis had made a mistake in calculating some stuff for their uranium bombs, and they decided to focus on a plutonium bomb. At least that's the story that General Gross, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, gave after the war. in reality, there was a gentleman by the name of Von Ardenna, a baron by the name of Von Ardenna. He was actually the guy who invented the first television to broadcast TV, which was at the Munich Olympics. And he...
The other person has cleared.
Oh, well, we seem to have lost him. Martin, we'll try and get Carter Heidrich back. But the implications here are that actually there were being deals, very important deals being done for this uranium at the end of the Second World War.
Well, it's interesting to speculate if that was the case. I mean, as you know, on this show, we have looked into what deals were done, particularly between Bormann and MI6 and the CIA towards the end of the war. And it's pretty clear, for example, when we see the former head of the Gestapo, Reinhard Gehlen, far from being punished at Nuremberg, he ends up running the German BND secret services at the end of the war. So it's pretty common knowledge that senior Nazis were integrated into what became NATO's intelligence structure at the end of the war. But the actual allegations that are made here are new to me. I'm not saying that I disagree. I would love to hear more, but we seem to have lost our...
No, we've got him back now.
We're back now.
Just to run through this article, which was in the Daily Mail and in the Daily Mirror in February this year, just before I went away for a month, so missed it. Anyway, secret files reveal Nazis tested nuclear bomb before end of World War II as Adolf Hitler plotted to decimate Britain. And I know Churchill was very worried that a nuclear warhead would be put onto a V2. And that's why they put a big priority on getting rid of these V2 sites. Documents unearthed in an American archive suggest Nazi Germany may have tested an operational nuclear bomb before the end of World War II. Recently declassified file APO696 from the National Archives in Washington is a detailed survey of how far the Third Reich scientists got in the development of the atomic bomb. Now, hopefully, Carter, you're back again, but I know in your research you found quite a lot of files had actually disappeared, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really interesting. When I went to look in the Oak Ridge National Laboratory files, which is where our enriched uranium was created, you go into the archives and you go into findings and you pull whatever documents look interesting. And when I went in there, I asked for 38 boxes of documents. And when they delivered them to me, all but four still had their classification seals on them. So the primary seminal documentation of what actually happened in the United States side of enriching uranium, at least, had not even been looked at by historians. I was the first one to open it. And in there, I found the uranium production records and all kinds of records that spoke to a decidedly different history than what had been given at the end of the war. Which, you know, was, you can understand at the end of the war with the Cold War coming, everything, you don't want to reveal everything. But now we're, you know, 70, 75 years later, it's time to look at this thing for real and see what really happened.
And now, this most recent documents from this declassified file, APO696, apparently, it's the daily newspaper in Germany, The Bild, that dug it out. So this is actually some primary research being done over in Germany, that there was investigations, research, development and practical use of the German atom bomb. But I think the newest thing is that these various eyewitnesses saying that they heard that they saw the mushroom cloud. A German test pilot, Hans Zintzer, is in the file. He is considered pretty good evidence. He says he's a missile expert and he observed in 1944 a mushroom cloud in the sky during a test flight near Ludwigslust. His log submitted to the Allied investigators reads, "In early October 1944, I flew away 12 to 15 kilometres from a nuclear test station near Ludwigslust. A cloud shaped like a mushroom with turbulent billowing sections about 7,000 metres high stood without any seeming connections over the spot where the explosion took place." But I suppose the other implication of this, Carter, is that there was this potential plan anyway to use nuclear weapons, not just against Japan, but also potentially against Russia too.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of... in my book, I cover several different kind of scenarios of what happened. It's important to understand that the United States was successful enriching uranium and was successful creating plutonium,
but they weren't going to have either bomb by before the end of 1945 or early 1946. The problem with that, for the United States at least, and all the allies, I think, was that Stalin had already said he was going to, and in fact did, declare war against the Japanese between when the Hiroshima bomb was dropped and when the Nagasaki bomb was dropped. And if you put that into a context of the military context of the time, he was already had a million men on his eastern front with Manchuria and China. And within 2 weeks after he declared war against Japan, he took over that territory, which protected his right flank. He was moving 3 million of his four million man army from Europe, where the war was ended, to Japan. So you think about 3 million Soviet troops, 600 miles across the Sea of Japan from Honshu, the main island of Japan. And if they could have jumped to Honshu and taken over Japan, in a heartbeat, long before we'd had our nuclear bomb and ended the war or been able to put an operation on Honshu with conventional means. What that would have done was change profoundly the complexion of the Cold War. The Soviet Union not only would have had East Europe, but they'd have had fundamentally all of the important pieces of the Asia-Pacific Rim, which Japan held. So you're talking Hong Kong, Singapore, China, Korea, Indonesia, all those resources and population. That would have made a profound difference. I think that's, in my mind, that's the most probable thing that would have happened. There are some others as well, but the war planners had to do something about that. And when the uranium from U-234 came up, I think they grabbed it, they snatched it, and used it for their purposes to end the war, as they did.
How come it never ended up in Japan, where it was supposed to go? I mean, so that's where this U-234 U-boat apparently was heading. Why didn't it end up in Japan?
Because by the time the Germans actually had an atomic bomb, they had lost superiority in the skies. They couldn't deliver it to a strategic target without a high possibility that they would lose it. And there was somewhat of a risk in sending it to Japan. I think Nazis at the very highest level who created and controlled their bomb used it, and there's ample evidence that this is the case, and covered in my book, I won't get into all the details, but they negotiated it to the United States as a secret part of Operation Sunrise, which was Alan Dulles when he surrendered, or he accepted or negotiated the surrender of Italy. That was part of that deal, and that deal allowed Martin Bormann particularly, but others, to survive the war and to maintain economic control of much of the previous German economy and help Germany revive after the war, which I believe is one of the reasons it revived so quickly after the war.
Now, on this U-234, sorry to interrupt you, but on this U-234, we're told there was just over half a metric ton of U-235, this enriched uranium. What sort of difference would that make to the ability of the Trinity test and the Manhattan Project to actually get operational bombs going?
Well, one of the things that everybody needs to understand is that while the uranium on the U-boat is part of the traditional history, and it's made admitted to, there's books about it, the traditional history says that uranium was raw uranium and couldn't have been made into natural bomb, however, into a nuclear bomb. However, and you look at the documentation of how it's stowed and the handling instructions and the fact it was labeled U-235, I've got at least five world-class physicists and nuclear engineers that say that was enriched uranium, it wasn't raw uranium. So that right there changes the fundamental truth of what that uranium is. And then the question becomes exactly what you said. Okay, so what did they do with it? Well, they used it to we were way behind in our uranium enrichment. They used it to complete our uranium bomb. And the U-boat also had proximity fuses. We were having serious trouble triggering the plutonium bomb. And the proximity fuses, and there was a scientist on board the U-boat by the name of Heinz Schlicke, German scientist, and he we believe he was provided the means to trigger the plutonium bomb. And by the way, the he's retired, a retired director of the nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which is did the engineering and testing of the bomb. His name's Delmar Bergen. He promotes my book. He wrote the foreword to it. He's one of the five physicists I quote that say that my book is correct, that this is what actually happened.
So what was Delmar Bergen's role in the Manhattan Project?
He wasn't actually in the Manhattan Project. He didn't go to work for the Los Alamos until 9 years after the war. But as he, you know, developed knowledge and talked to these people, and through his own knowledge and understanding as he read the evidence that I present in Critical Mass, he realized that the traditional history wasn't correct and that I had corrected. The official historian for Oak Ridge National Laboratory for the actual uranium enrichment site, his name's Ray Webb, he also endorses the book and says it should be in every library. It's the correct version of what happened.
Now, Winston Churchill in 1945 was voted out of office, but there was something called Operation Unthinkable. He was actually suggesting, and in fact he had to be kept off the BBC because he was seen to be a little bit batty about the idea that it would be possible to nuke Moscow. Immediately he was into the whole sort of Cold War thing. So in July 1945, there were already plans apparently to launch an attack on the Soviet Union. I just wonder what you make of that, because it seems as if that they were instantly and rather too quickly after the Second World War, the United States and Britain, and thankfully, we had a new government in Britain that wasn't Winston Churchill, embracing the Germans and the Nazis in order to fight Russia.
I think all of those things are very, very plausible and probably true. I haven't studied that specific area. I don't know for sure, but it sounds logical that, you know, there was a whole large wing of the Allies, both in the UK and in America and elsewhere, that said, you know, we're over there, let's finish the job and go on, so we know we're going to end up fighting the Soviets. And I can easily see people promoting using nuclear weapons there. And with you, I'm glad it wasn't done. I think that would have taken us down a terrible path. I think as scary and weird as it was to have mutual assured destruction in the Cold War, I think that we navigated it probably, you know, better than what would have happened had the other path been chosen.
What about, you mentioned Alan Dulles briefly. What was his role in all of this? Because I know he was involved in Switzerland, for example. I mean, he would have been very much in understanding what was happening to the Nazi loot from the Second World War, much of which was deposited in Switzerland. And so what was his role over stateside?
So he was, Franklin Roosevelt's direct link to Europe and the intelligence in Europe. He almost reported directly to Roosevelt, and not anybody else, as I understand it. And he, a little earlier in the war, I want to say later in 1943, a German who came to Dulles, his last name was Longbein, according to Dulles, and he presented some materials, some documents that talked about a commercial exchange between Nazi Germany and other foreign countries, and they didn't get specific about it. This man's last name was Longbein, and so I'm just going to leave that little pile of information right there for a second. A little later, not much later, a few months later, Dulles was approached again by emissaries from Karl Wolff, who was the plenipotentiary of Italy. Now, Karl Wolff had quite a background before he was plenipotentiary for Italy, which means he controlled, other than the military offensive and defensive, the civilian population of Italy he was responsible for, and the occupation. Prior to that, he had been in charge of the synthetic rubber plant, the building of the synthetic rubber plant that you had mentioned earlier, that actually never created any synthetic rubber, used more power than the city of Berlin. And there's no explanation for what happened there, until you compare the characteristics of that plant with the characteristics of the uranium-enriched plant at Oak Ridge, and all of a sudden you see, oh, that's what it was. It was an uranium-enriched plant. So Carl Wolf goes from there to be in the penitentiary of Italy and fairly quickly makes contact with Dulles and says, hey, let's talk about some negotiated surrender. And Dulles, you know, the open story, the legend, if I can call it that, is that the ally said unconditional surrender is the only thing we'll accept, and that's what Dulles supposedly told Wolf. But there's plenty of evidence that there was a sub-negotiation between very few people. Dulles, the gentleman, Dulles' right-man hand, named Zero von Gevernitz, and Wolf and a few of his close associates himself. And that's when Wolf, who knew was responsible for creating the actual material, German material for a bomb, took it to the United States and said, if you give us this, if we will give you this if you give us protection after the war, allow us to escape and give us protection after the war. And there's, I don't want to go down too many rat holes, but there's a bunch of information in the book that backs that up about how when Wolf was interrogated after the war, he was he actually talked to Adolf Hitler about negotiating the secret weapon instead of using it because they couldn't use it when they after they lost air superiority. So that's where Wolf and Dulles plays in. Dulles is the one who headed on the United States side, the Allied side, the negotiation for not only the surrender of Italy's of Germany's southern front, but more importantly, the surrender of U-234 and its bomb components that were that then, you know, changed not only the tide of the war, the tide was set, but changed the end of the war and the players in the new world that evolved after that.
Yes, but I mean, there's a lot of people, sort of British historians, have sort of complained, I suppose, about the fact that we had Frisch and Piles, who'd originally developed in Birmingham the idea for the atomic bomb on the Allied side, went over to the United States. Churchill sent them over there to develop the bomb. But then, towards the end of the war, there was an agreement saying, well, actually, the United States is not going to share any of what the development has achieved with the British, and the British were shut out. So, you know, we developed our own bomb in the late 1940s and 50s. But I know, Carter, I think originally you wrote this book in the 1990s, but you had quite a lot of trouble getting it out there, I understand.
It was, I think I mentioned to you earlier in some private correspondence that it took quite a toll on my life. Yes, I spent quite a bit. I spent 10 years researching and writing it to begin with, as well as the amount of money I won't repeat here, but it was a lot. Wrote the book and put it out. I tried to get journalists and historians, professors to, you know, originally before I even tried to write it, to get them to say, hey, look at this, and nobody wanted to touch it. They said, no way, that's real. And so because I made my living as a communicator and knew how to research and knew how to write, I felt like, you know, there's a line in the movie National Treasure. I don't know if you've seen that, but somebody asked him why he's doing what he does. He says, if you know something's wrong and you have the capacity to fix it, you have the responsibility to fix it. And that was the attitude I took. And so I dug in there and started going after it, and I came up with these revelations that really changed the course of history.
But it is in print now, so you've got a bit of a better publisher, have you?
It's in print. It's actually the first two editions were self-published because I couldn't get a publisher. I couldn't get anybody else to help me with it. Now, I will say the second edition actually ended up on the physical shelves of Barnes & Noble, which it was the 13th or 14th self-published book out of 6 or 7 million at that point to actually reach the shelf. So it did well. When it went out of print, over the course of the next 10 years, it became kind of a collector's item within the conspiracy theory community, and copies of the first or second edition, hard copies, were going for $450 to $600. So there was people out there realized, hey, this is true. They want to get the book. They valued it, but it was hard to get. When the discovery of spent uranium that was
documented to be left over from the Nazi atomic bomb project was made in Germany, it became obvious that I needed to update the book and put out a third edition. And so I put out a third edition about a year ago, and it's doing well. And fortunately, Trine Daily Publishers published it, so you can get this information now with the updates on it, you know, for a reasonable price for a book. But it was, yeah, it was a grueling, hard process. It almost destroyed my marriage and my family, and I had to kind of double back and put everything away after the second edition and spend some time healing some wounds. A little personal, but it's part of the process.
Well, listen, Carl DeHardrick, we'll put a link up on our show page to your book, to the Trinity Day site. Thank you ever so much for sharing all that with us. And thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Tony. Thank you.
Now, Martin, interesting story, isn't it? And I think maybe one of the reasons why there was so difficult for him to get that published is because the links between Nazi Germany and the United States are almost weekly, we're seeing more and more evidence that there was a tremendous amount of closeness between the two. Really, in a way, starting with the attempted coup in the 1930s by Prescott Bush and the collaboration and cooperation, even in the 30s, between a Nazi Germany and certain fascist elements within the US.
Yeah, and I think don't forget that this isn't just of historical interest, is it? I mean, I think Carter there, perhaps naively thinking that this was just, you know, it's 70 years ago now, let's look into this. It's still live. And as I said earlier on, the evidence that elements within the Nazi state were protected and actually absorbed into the Western intelligence structure in the 1940s, I think that's overwhelming. The question is, how far did it go and how deep did it run? And if they, you know, the elements within the Nazi regime helped the West to develop nuclear weapons as part of a deal to protect themselves, that would fit in with what we know about other things that went on.
Interesting, too, that Deputy Director of the Los Alamos, Delmar Bergen, Dr. Delmar Bergen, has endorsed his book.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, Bergen wasn't there at the time. But nevertheless, he's a nuclear scientist, presumably of some standing, otherwise he wouldn't be working at Los Alamos.
Deputy Director of Los Alamos.
Yes.
And has written the foreword to his book. I just also wonder what you make of these claims that we had the Nazis had a nine-month lead on the United States developing nuclear weapons.
Well, I mean, it begs the question, why didn't they use them? But it could well be, as we're discovering.
Well, as he said there, first of all, he said they didn't have a delivery system, although they did have the V-2. They may have decided to use their atomic bomb as a kind of bargaining chip.
Yeah, well, somebody decided to use it as a bargaining chip, because, of course, what the Nazis could have done, if they'd got a bomb, packed it onto a V-2, they could have nuked Britain, but they couldn't nuke the United States of America. And the United States of America would still be there, you know, the biggest power on the planet, etc. It wouldn't win the war for them, would it? It just wasn't big enough. So you could see why elements within the Nazi state might say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to do a deal with the elements within the Western establishment with whom we've already got contacts going back to the 1930s.
Also, interesting what he was saying about, on the surface, it being unconditional surrender. And yet, at the same time, amongst a handful of people, deals were being done.
Yeah, well, I mean, that fits in what we've been about what we've been saying about Martin Bormann escaping from Berlin. He was, as far as we know, rescued by a British squad, Royal Navy squad, led by John Ainsworth Davis. And I think that's because the Nazis themselves were not all in on the deal. It's quite likely that Bormann was double-crossing his boss Hitler by doing this deal. And that Hitler would have probably wanted to fight to the end with a nuclear bomb and all the rest of it. But, of course, others had a more kind of self-preservationary attitude.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, bringing it all up to the present day, we have a little bit of a problem, don't we, Martin, over in Syria at the moment. It looks as if as the Russians and the Syrian government, not the Syrian regime, the Syrian government, retake their country. Also, we've heard this week that one of the most, or the last isolated pockets of ISIS in Iraq has fallen in Mosul. So it does look as if this whole sort of ISIS menace is drawing to a close in Iraq, and at the same time it seems to be still surviving in Syria, except it also looks as if there's been an attempt. Well, on Monday there was a statement from Michael Fallon and from James Mattis, US Defense Secretary, that if there is another chemical weapons attack in Syria, it will definitely be Assad that's done it.
Well, I mean, they've been all over the place on that this week. I think it was Trump or was it Mattis was saying that we've got evidence that they're preparing another chemical weapons attack. Fallon was certainly saying it, like the one that we saw in Idlib, although all the evidence, Seymour Hersh writing in Die Welt, German serious newspaper, and he's very, very serious, high-level investigative journalist, he says there was no evidence that the Assad regime used chemical weapons in Idlib. But nevertheless, we're being told that they did and that they're planning to do some more. And then Mattis, I think, came out and said, and now we're confident that they're not going to do it because we've threatened them and they've decided that they're not going to do it. Now, in other words, we're now dealing with a kind of Alice in Wonderland world where completely unbelievable allegations are made and then they're withdrawn because the US military and the US establishment are at loggerheads about what to do here. Basically, their strategy of supporting al-Qaeda and ISIS to overthrow Assad has backfired spectacularly. It hasn't succeeded. It's caused a lot of pain and misery and death, but they failed militarily, and there's a danger now that they're going to double down, or elements within the military and intelligence community in the US are not prepared to accept defeat, which is why they're quite prepared to escalate at this point. But that's the fear, that they're not actually rational.
So we're going to have a look now at these US fascist incubators and looking at their purpose, really, which seems to be largely to do with sort of expansionism. That is to say, kind of privatised industries, privatised companies going in and making money from reconstruction, but also, Martin, private military companies making money and mercenaries making money. In fact, this is something the Russian President Vladimir Putin was saying recently, was that really it's just a question of who offers the more money, whether it's ISIS or the Free Syrian Army or al-Nusra, who these guys fight for over in Syria.
Well, ultimately, what we're dealing with is a military-industrial complex which makes its money through war and therefore goes around promoting war directly and indirectly, including supporting extremists of the left, the right, and the Islamists in order to create enemies which they can then be employed to destroy. And it's a strategy of tension driven by greed, which we've got overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have been engaging with for decades. But of course, they run up against the Russians who are wise to what they're up to and are not easily pushed over. So they're in a bit of a pickle.
Do you think the Russians are being bamboozled?
I don't think the Russians are being bamboozled. The problem for them is that they don't want World War III like any rational person wouldn't. They could take a much harder line than they have, but they're trying to find a way to deal with the situation, to diffuse the crazy war-mongering attitudes that they're coming across when they're dealing with Western interlocutors. But the way they're doing it is the very sensible way, which is not to confront them directly, just to leave them in a position where they can't really do what they want because they just can't.
Anyway, we're going to hear now from former US naval intelligence asset Kenyon Gibson now. He was also infiltrating drug gangs, I believe, in New York as well. And one of the things that he did almost in his spare time when he was living over here in the UK was to infiltrate fascist groups in London. But he did the same sort of thing when he was over in the United States recently, speaking to a guy called Michael Bagley. So anyway, let's hear it from Kenyon Gibson now. He's trying to look at these fascist groups and how they're completely connected with war and making money from war.
Michael Bagley. Bagley is head of a company called Jellyfish, and he used to work for Operations Intelligence. He was recruited by Jellyfish. He was sent to Syria. And I met him at Penn Station. I spoke to him undercover, acting as if I was a member of an international group of Nazis and terrorist supporters. He knew somebody in London named Jonathan Boulter, who is a serious Satanist and sadist and into all these groups. Boulter sent me an email saying that Syria was to become a mini Halliburton, and Bagley had the keys to Syria. Bagley represents one of the three branches of U.S. intelligence, and that's private intelligence, the other two being military intelligence and government intelligence, which is CIA, DIA, NSA, Homeland Security, etc. So private intel companies being used to do what they want, with the American government able to deny what's going on, but also these private intel agencies, as Bagley told me, he basically laughed at the notion that he was doing this for Americans. He's never been a serviceman. He told me flat out he was doing it for the money. And Trump comes to power in January of this year, and he doesn't know what's going on. The private intel companies just hope to create their mini Halliburton and make a lot of money like they've done elsewhere around the world and in Vietnam, as I just mentioned. So Trump sees a mess, and one day something bad happens, and his daughter comes to him and says, "Daddy, you know, kids are being killed," and Trump puts a stop to it in a very humanitarian way. I have to give him credit. He called and said, "Look, we're going to bomb you, so why don't you get out of the way, but we want to get rid of these chemical weapons." So no civilians were killed. There was no loss of American soldiers either. He did as the commander-in-chief ought to have done. He got some criticism. He got support. But he was not acting out of a desire to hurt Russia, hurt Syria, or hurt anyone. And that's very important. Unfortunately, though, with secret actors like Michael Bagley and Jellyfish, a.k.a. Blackwater, as it used to be called, but it changes its name, maybe because it's ashamed of its past activities, in there, nobody really knows what's going on. So Russia and America are brought to friction over the actions of people like Michael Bagley, just as America and Vietnam were brought to war because people like whoever the forces were that killed John F. Kennedy wanted the war for their own profit.
Well, that's interesting. I'm afraid I don't agree that Trump acted well there. Trump shouldn't have carried out the cruise missile attacks. He killed five children.
But look,
more
to the point, I mean, we're looking here at whether Syria is really nothing to do with whether chemical weapons are or aren't being used. It's all about Blackwater mercenaries in Halliburton.
Well, yes, I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it, to anybody who looks into this. The military-industrial complex has got its own interests. It likes wars because wars are where it makes its money.
And I guess what Kenyon Zets is saying there is that because Trump is a property developer, it's quite easy to bamboozle him in situations
That's right.
like this.
He's not really competent to be running a show like that, is he?
Well, he's kind of pushing out most of his foreign policy to the generals.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, Trump's basically a chump. And he's easily bamboozled. He made the decision. He, of course, the way he managed it is he told the Russians, "Yes, we're going to carry out this strike, but we're going to give you warning." And of course, therefore, no Russians were killed, but I'm afraid some children were killed nearby, five at least. And of course, it was supposedly because Ivanka got really upset about the children who died. And of course, the other thing about the original chemical weapons attack is it's quite likely that the rebels who we arm and train, they carried it out and killed those people. And therefore, we should be attacking them. And in case we're going to attack them, we might as well attack
ourselves.
What's
the state of play with this chemical weapons attack? What do you think now? Who was behind it? What happened?
Well, the evidence, there's various theories floating around that there was some kind of chemicals released. Least during an air attack on the
because I understand Seymour Hersh has weighed in on this one.
Yeah, but Seymour Hersh said what Seymour Hersh has got is he's getting the inside gen from people in the military. That's what makes his stuff so good. But of course, they've also got an interest in selling a certain line. Yeah, so we get inside information, but it's quite possible that he's only getting half the truth. The Russians have looked at the videos and they're pretty much convinced that the videos are fakes. That there is nothing happening here other than people pretending that something's happening. So, for example, the whole idea that it was sarin use is completely ridiculous because the people in the videos have got no protective clothing on.
It's potentially dramatising a situation like this. Quite a powerful way, isn't it, of drumming up a market for people like Blackwater Jellyfish.
Well, of course it is. And of course, the whole thing about children are being killed by these evil people, that's a way to get people aren't really paying attention, emotionally engaged, so that we can then go... I mean, of course, and it worked for Trump. He carried out the cruise missile attacks, the Tomahawk tweet, and then his opinion polls rating 60% of the US approved of what he'd done. That's because people are being bamboozled. They're being bamboozled by their own intelligence services. Intelligence services, as we've just discussed, learnt most of their techniques from the Nazis, who were integrated into those intelligence services when NATO was set up. Incidentally, I was reading this week Oliver Stone's interview with Putin, and Putin said, we've got overwhelming evidence that the snipers in the Maidan Square that killed the Holy Hundred in the coup in Ukraine were trained by NATO special forces. So in other words, not only are the Russians and the Syrians not engaged in these evil acts, we are carrying out those evil acts. And that means, if you're not a pacifist, Tony, that some top US, British and other generals either go to prison or get their brains blown out.
Well, another development this week, Jewish Voice UK has launched a social media campaign to fight Tommy Robinson and the far right. And I'm just going to read their statement out now, or parts of it anyway. Tommy Robinson has on a number of occasions attempted to co-opt the Jewish community to further his abhorrent Islamophobic rhetoric, presumably in an attempt to gain legitimacy off the back of the legitimate fears regarding rising anti-Semitism. They say now, let us be very clear, Tommy Robinson is not a friend of the Jews. He is a pernicious man, a purveyor of division and othering. Vision of the diverse Jewish community are in direct conflict with those things. Islamophobia is considered a new phenomenon by most, but it isn't. It's the foreign threat that racist elements in our society have been peddling for centuries. Now, this goes on, and I'll put a link to it on our show page. But, Martin, it's interesting to see Tommy Robinson saying, well, I'm sticking up for the Jews against Islam, but actually Jewish Voice UK, a Jewish media group, both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine, is saying, we want nothing to do with you, Tommy.
Well, I've never heard of the group before, but obviously I agree with what they're saying there. And it's very welcome that they've spoken out.
And also, when I spoke to Kenyon Gibson earlier this week, I spoke to him also about fascist groups in the UK, far-right and fascist groups in the UK. And he's talking here about fascist incubators. He's talking about the people behind Britain First and something called the New Left. And he also mentions again Michael Bagley in the United States. So here's former US Naval Intelligence agent Kenyon Gibson, who also worked infiltrating drug gangs in New York.
There was a range of groups, from small groups that had very few members, and you know, the fewer members, the more outraged they were. So there's a guy, Kevin Quinn. Kevin Quinn was probably the most outrageous because he openly claimed that he believed in Nazism and Red Mein Kampf. He had the least members, and he changed the name of his group from the November 9th Society to the British First Party. Then there was the British People's Party, which was very small. The British National Party, which was the biggest, but shied away from out-and-out Nazism. They had a lot of problems after they were infiltrated by a Guardian reporter in about 2008. And I got into a lesser-known group that has the most power of them all, called New Right. New Right had meetings of about 60 people once a month in London at a secret location. You'd come to a location, and then everybody would get a secret text telling you that wasn't the location, and Jonathan Boulter would show up and lead you to a pub. There'd be four speakers. I was a speaker on a couple of occasions, but mainly the speakers were all anti-Semitic. You had a range of people who were also anti-Muslim to Muslim-speaking who hated Jews, but anti-Semitism was a common denominator there. And there was a lot of networking going on. So some people in that group were just right-wing activists who had no clue, and they paid their $5 to sit in this group and have a pint downstairs. And then others were much more powerful, like Jonathan Boulter, who personally knew Adrian Davies QC, who knew the late Jonathan Bowden, who knew Darius Guppy, the man who punched out Princess Diana's brother. And so the more powerful elite in these groups went around the world and had contacts with people like Michael Bagley. They are rather silly groups. So let me explain. You're a taxpayer, and these funds that you give to the government every year get partially allocated to intelligence agencies, and in the U.S., private intelligence agencies, and these private intelligence agencies then turn around and use this money to create problems and wars and make money for themselves and their affiliates.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what goes on. And the private intelligence agencies are pernicious. What's happened with the CIA, it's become a huge subcontracting exercise these days. But underlying all of this, there are even bigger fish who are playing geopolitical games on an even bigger level.
It sounds from what Ken is saying. I mean, it's quite plucky of him, I suppose, to infiltrate these groups and even to get to speak on the same platform as serious anti-Semites in order to sort of keep his cover going. But effectively, we are in a situation where the far right does seem completely immune to any kind of arrests and prosecutions when it comes to actually fomenting Islamophobia.
Listen, what we believe, and we've got quite a lot of evidence to suggest it, is that both extremist Muslims and extremist right-wingers are being encouraged in their bad behaviour and their bad talking in order to create a conflict in society, which then allows the private security industry to make a killing pretending to sort it out. And I think it's not insignificant that both the English Defence League and Al-Majah Harun, one of the most extreme of the Muslim front organisations, both appeared simultaneously in Luton some years ago. And it's very, very bizarre that they both appear simultaneously, supposedly hate each other's guts, absolute excuse for a punch-up, but they just appear both at the same time, and I don't think that's an accident. I think we've got intelligence agencies who are, and private agencies, stirring the pot here. They want to see trouble. Trouble is their business.
And Martin, finally tonight, a new batch of Turkish troops arrives in Qatar. It doesn't look as if it's going to be a pushover for the Saudis.
Well, it's not going to be enough to stop a Saudi invasion if a Saudi invasion takes place. The purpose of the Turkish troops being there is to turn it into an international incident if that happens. I mean, as we sit here, Tony, on this Friday, the 30th of June 2017, we are really on the brink of an accident here just waiting to happen in Syria, in Qatar, somewhere else completely different. The possibilities here of a major Third World War are staring us all in the face. And there's so much going on that people can't keep up with it all.
Well, we try and make sure that we stay abreast of it. Qatar is one place, yep. And Syria is another. But it does
and
look
North
as if,
Korea.
With the situation in Syria particularly, as it returns to peace, so it almost looks as if another incident is going to have to happen there to make sure the war carries on.
That's right, because the forces we're talking about simply can't accept defeat. The obvious solution, if you had a rational people running the West, is to just accept defeat, shake hands with Putin, shake hands with Assad, try and sort the problem out, but that's not going to happen.
Why don't they do that?
Because they don't make money out of making peace, Tony. They never have.
Isn't it a criminal elite that they're scared?
Yes,
that if there is
criminal,
any kind of just a minute, hang on, let me finish. If there is any real democracy, those people running the show would be under arrest.
They would indeed, and they are terrorists and drug dealers and murderers. But ultimately, we're going to have to deal with them, and it's going to have to be dealt with by civilian police officers working under the direction of democratic forces.
Do you see any parallels with the beginning of the First World War or the Second World War? Certainly economically, there seem to be similarities.
It's the same sort of setup, but on steroids. And of course, this one is going to be the big one. It's going to make the other two look like a walk in the park.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights here this week with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Eastern Afzal Shah. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, to Carter Heydrich, and to Robert Atkinson from Kensington and Chelsea Council in the first hour too. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car, iPlayer, anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10. And get the real musical deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch.
Tough with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at the state of our so-called free press, media mendacity, and manufacturing consent in the Trump era. We're joined by journalist Abby Martin of The Empire Files, which airs on Telesur. Whistleblowing journalist and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson joins the conversation. And Project Censored senior correspondent Michael Levitin speaks to Justin Schlossberg. He's the chair of the Media Reform Coalition at the University of London. An hour analyzing media on the Project Censored show. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the state of our so-called free press. We'll be discussing media mendacity, so-called fake news, and manufacturing consent in the Trump era. Our first guest today, returning to the program, is journalist Abby Martin of The Empire Files, which airs on Telesur. Abby Martin, of course, is founder of Media Roots and had a program on Russia Today called Breaking the Set. And Abby Martin, of course, goes back with us a ways at Project Censored on the board at Media Freedom Foundation. Abby, thanks for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mickey and Peter.
So, Abby, not long ago, you were back in the corporate news media, and this time it was the New York Times. Can you sort of recap for us that latest fracas with the New York Times propaganda and misinformation?
Sure. Well, as we know, leading up to Donald Trump's inauguration, there was a concerted effort on behalf of the establishment, both the political establishment, neoconservatives, neoliberals, as well as the entire media apparatus, trying to push this Russia hacked the election story so much to the point where 52% of registered Democrats actually believed that Russia actually altered the vote. So this was a huge concerted effort. I feel like a lot of deep state activity to try to delegitimize Trump. I absolutely hate Trump. I think he's terribly frightening, and we can go into that later. But this was a very clear effort to try to do that. The DNI intelligence report that came out that was long awaited, waiting for this so-called evidence of Russian interference in our election, was really just a thrown-together hodgepodge document that looked like it was done in an hour by some Heritage Foundation intern. Basically, it was just half bashing RT programming, Russia Today programming.
By the way, you haven't been on Russia Today for how long?
2 years.
Right. So I guess they're catching up to you.
Exactly. So this is a claim by the intelligence community on behalf of these 17 agencies that Russia Today, specifically my show, was this kind of propaganda vector when the Kremlin decided to interfere in our elections and start to foment this radical discontent. They called my show Fomenting Radical Discontent, which is a very Orwellian, neo-McCarthyist term that is very scary. Fast forward to the New York Times, that not only published an article that day saying this report is damning, serious allegations here, total slam dunk, right? You have Rachel Maddow, all these other people in the establishment press saying it was amazing, slam dunk. But the next day after defended the intelligence report, they actually had the audacity, Russ Goldman was the author, to write a piece using me and Liz Wall as these prime examples of Russia Today anchors that quit in protest,
right,
and denounced the station as Russian propaganda. And this article was up for an entire day. I don't know how many people read the New York Times. Thank God it wasn't printed in their actual edition in New York, but it was up on the website for a day after many people told him it was full of egregious lies. And in fact, when I finally forced him to correct it, he did. But when he corrected it, it still pushed forward a narrative that was false. It still said, oh, I quit sometime after I denounced Putin propaganda on air. That's completely erroneous. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were misconstruing the truth because they knew that the truth actually undermined their entire narrative, which is that I was able to denounce RT's programming and Putin and still keep the primetime show on the network for a year and still speak out against Russia and still speak out whenever I wanted to. So really, what does that say? It says that I was able to push my editorial freedom far beyond, I'm sure, people at the New York Times ever will.
Or CNN, for that matter.
It seems like intelligence agencies are still living in the communist era, the Cold War era, and bringing some of that theme back, and that the Russians are hacking U.S. Democrats and up to mischief, and that you're a agent of provocation or fermenting their ideas. And once you do that, once you're a commie, you're always a commie, I think, is the history of that. Even though you haven't been there in 2 years and you're doing other stuff.
Putin's not a commie.
Exactly. But there's still that belief and system there. So were you charged with fake news?
I've kind of thrown in the crosshairs here because, of course, the Democrats have now riled up this, like, anti-communist fervor, you know? Like, a lot of
Indeed.
Liberals are now hating on communists. They're using this iconography of the hammer and sickle. It's very confused. There cannot be a legitimate resistance against Trump if people are confused and conflating communism with capitalism. And in fact, not even capitalism. It's this oligarchic ruling class that is basically the same, whether you're looking at the U.S. or Russia. So, yes, of course I was called fake news. I'm called fake news by, you know, this term has been weaponized now. We handed it basically to Trump, where now he can just call anything that disagrees with his alternative facts fake news. And good job, corporate media, for now trying to weaponize this term. Delegitimizing all non-corporate media. That's what they were doing. Publish a list that literally was just alternative media, non-corporate funded as fake news.
And Abby Martin, that went back to Proper Not, right? And that was run by a former national security editor, Craig Timberg, over at the Washington Post, who didn't vet it, didn't research it at all, just ran that list. And, of course, many independent journalists were on that list, many of them, of course, whom we know. And, again, some of them threatened to sue for slander or libel. They had a very tepid retraction on that. Of course, they were later caught, the Washington Post, in their own fake news tornado when they talked about the Russians hacking the power grid in Vermont. Right. All the while peddling
Absolutely.
Fake news. And let's trace fake news back a little bit in terms of its most recent incarnation or iteration coming out of the DNC as a red herring to blame this issue, fake news, to call attention away from the horrible campaign that the Democrats ran.
Yeah, absolutely. There was someone that just did a study on the whole fake news hysteria and found out, guess what? Fake news had virtually no impact on the election.
And the term fake news, like you said, it's also now weaponized. And thanks to the use of it in corporate media, specifically from the liberal angle, right, neoliberal angle, mm-hmm. that the Democrats are trying to distract away from their candidate, from their problems, from the chicanery in their own primary regarding Bernie Sanders and the corruption at the DNC and the so-called leadership there. Now the term fake news, like you said, they midwifed it right into corporate media and right over to Donald Trump. And now it's weaponized. And can be used in any direction.
And he's already shown such utter contempt for the press. I am the least bit of an apologist or for corporate news networks, as you know, Mickey and Peter. But wow, when I see a sitting president treating the press corps with this much contempt, that's a scary, scary trend.
That certainly is an amazing piece of what's been happening. I mean, the New York Times actually has said Trump lied, but NPR won't say he lied. They're simply saying that, well, he probably didn't understand, maybe didn't really know it wasn't a truth or something along that line, kind of apologetic. Do you think the New York Times is taking a lead in challenging Trump?
No, and they've really lost their legitimacy, unfortunately, because when you just shill 100% for one corporate candidate over the other, it does make people trust you less. So I don't think the New York Times is really the people that are going to be marching forward on this path to resist Trump. I think it needs to still come from the alternative media. And I think that people across the board need to stop misunderstanding that Breitbart and InfoWars are somehow truthful alternative press. It seems like there's a big conflation now on behalf of the establishment to try to demonize alternative media as fake news. Now we have this tug and pull amongst alternative news networks that are legitimate, let's say Truthdig, Project Censored, Counterpunch, now battling with actual fake news. When I say fake news, I mean Breitbart, InfoWars, people who pull up these hysterical fear-mongering narratives about Islam, immigrants, refugees, and women, and use it to bait people in order to bolster their agenda and narrative. I think that we all need to be calling Trump the pathological liar that he is, instead of obsessing endlessly down this rabbit hole of every single time that he releases a false statement or knowingly lie. We need to simply say he's a pathological liar, correct it, of course, but not endlessly debate this, because he is a master manipulator and he knows how to hijack the media. This is what he's been doing this whole time. That's why he's president. So we need to stop reacting and be in front of the curve here.
Abby Martin, speaking of being in front of that curve, again, this is handed basically right over to Trump. And Steve Bannon, who is all over in the White House from Breitbart.com, former CEO there, knows very well how to hijack narratives, knows very well how to distract and bait and switch, knows very well how to throw the red meat to the lion, so to speak. And, you know, when Trump first came in and went to the CIA, of all places, he used it as a platform with his fake crowd, right, clapping for him.
Mm-hmm.
to attack and denigrate the media. He'd use his bizarre announcement for Black History Month to attack the media. I mean, so this is definitely a tactic that we see coming out. And he specifically has been singling out CNN. And I read a Reuters piece about reacting to this. And I'm just curious to hear, what do you think, as a journalist, should be the kind of reaction to this treatment and this hostility?
It's getting really rabid. A lot of people are conflating now free speech to basically neo-Nazis and all of these alt-right people. Look, I personally don't think that we should be using federal-funded public institutions to give platforms to hateful fear-mongers like these. I mean, of course, I'm not advocating shutting down. They're free to do whatever they want. They're free to go speak. I'm just saying the rhetoric now is so heightened and divisive, and that's exactly what people like Steve Bannon and Trump want. I think that liberals and leftists need to unite. I think that instead of blaming leftists for the loss, the abysmal loss and crushing of the Clinton dynasty, they need to be reaching out and understanding why they need this base in order to create a united front against Trump. I think the responsibility of journalists and editors is to not only react, of course, to these Trump statements and to dissect the rhetoric and say what's true and false, but I think it's a huge loss when you're not using your analysis to give a deeper context to why these things are happening. Islamophobia didn't just happen in a vacuum. This has been fostered and cultivated for the last 15 years. The systems have been in place. We have a police state apparatus, a surveillance state apparatus. We have all been talking about this for the last 15 years. We never carried water for any sitting president. We understood precisely the dangers of creating something like the National Defense Authorization Act, the eradication of habeas corpus. We understood that once a demagogic crazy person like Trump, who would be in power of these things, that's how dangerous and quickly things can unfold. So I think that the media is really doing a disservice when they don't explain how these things happened and why. And also, they're complicit because they allowed Obama to perpetuate this entire system. And when you don't prosecute war criminals and when you don't stop bombing seven Muslim countries, well, then you're going to get Trump and you're going to get the Muslim ban because Islamophobia has been rooted in this country for the last 15 years.
Abby, you interviewed Noam Chomsky in December. This was before the inauguration. And he's quoting Norman Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute as saying the Republican Party is a radical insurgency, which has abandoned the parliamentary politics, and they're just ready to go bomb people. Do you think that he was accurate in describing it that way?
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of people, like Chris Hedges is really into explaining how the Christian right has used all these institutions over the last 30 years. And we see that, you know, the fruition of people like Mike Pence and Betsy DeVos. And now Eric Prince is now advising Trump behind the scenes. Very scary Christian evangelical figures. However, the alt-right, I think, is a new movement that isn't even necessarily Christian, yet they embody all this kind of fascistic rhetoric and really hateful tendencies. And I think that there's two forces that we need to be worried about. I think the Republicans were on their way out until Trump was able to capture that kind of populist rhetoric. And Steve Bannon, I really think, is the Karl Rove behind Trump's brain. And I think that when you look at Steve Bannon's rhetoric and what he's been doing the last 10 years, he has been fostering that kind of Alex Jonesy audience where he's saying we need to overthrow the Republican establishment. We need to abolish the Republican establishment. They hated those traditional Republicans. They said that they were weak. It's been an ethno-white nationalist push, very ideologically driven. And so you have two fronts now where you see kind of the old Republican guard leeching on the power. All those never Trumpers, where the hell are they? They seem to be falling in line quicker than anyone else, you know, other than the Democrats, of course. So I do think there are two forces we need to be fighting equally, but also understanding how they're different and similar.
Including Senator Tim Kaine, who has greenlighted all of these Trump nominations. That's not getting a lot of attention. You know, you mentioned something here, Abby Martin. Those of you just tuning in, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. We're speaking with journalist Abby Martin. Her recent show is called The Empire Files on Telesur. Abby Martin, you know, the term alt-right is being thrown around a lot, and we use it because it's sort of a zeitgeist. But is alt-right also some kind of dog whistling for what you also said? You said white nationalist, and we are also seeing terms like neo-fascist.
Yes, I think that really when you look at the alt-right, you know, I said before, it's not necessarily that they're even Christian. They don't have a political ideology. The alt-right is basically a reactionary force off of PC culture and what they call globalism, right? We've heard these dog whistling terms for a while. I think a lot of people who are in the conspiratorial framework heard these terms back in the day and thought maybe the New World Order the elite, but now it's become a term that's actually vehemently like racist, anti-immigrant, nationalist. And you've seen people like Steve Bannon really take that globalism term and run with it. And I think that the alt-right really arose out of internet message boards. People have been emboldened that are essentially trolls. We have essentially an online troll in the White House. Trump is probably an atheist, for goodness sake, but he has cultivated and captured this base of people who now are proud and emboldened from their own bigotry. And it really came out of the throes of like university culture, this PC, you know, safe spaces. That's what these people are obsessed with. They think their biggest enemy is leftists and social justice warriors, they call them. And that to me is an extreme distortion on who the actual enemy is, the ruling class, the oligarchy, and the U.S. empire that carries out endless militarism around the world. And if we are distracted and baited by this group of vitriolic, hateful people who want to attack leftists, they're just doing the bidding of the empire now. I mean, how does that feel, guys? You're carrying water for a sitting president and now making leftists the enemy instead of militarism and empire. But I honestly don't think these people actually have a political ideology. They're just a reactionary force that's been given an extreme amount of power, and we see them all over the streets now taking that power to the streets.
We're speaking with journalist Abby Martin from the Empire Files, airs on Pellissure. So, Abby Martin, tell us a little bit more about Steve Bannon.
Steve Bannon is a guy, he was a Navy officer, he was a Goldman Sachs banker. He hitched his wagon to Drudge and Andrew Breitbart. He was kind of their protege. And of course, when Breitbart died at a young age, Steve Bannon really took the helm of that website. He's called it the hub of the alt-right. He's given a voice, really, to these white nationalists and really created that haven for them to thrive and grow. Steve Bannon really, like I said, he hitched his wagon to the right people. Trump has basically rewarded the people who worship him. So, you know, he's given power to all these GOP outliers who are considered too crazy even to be taken seriously by the mainstream Republican establishment. And Steve Bannon not only is a serial wife beater and child abuser, which really says a lot about his capabilities of actually like killing someone who's capable of strangling and choking their wife. Studies show that they're capable of murdering them as well. So that aside, he has for the last 10 years been pulling forward this Muslim ban idea, pushing forward the idea of no immigrants. He even said that the biggest problem with America is the fact that there are 20% immigrants here. And then he has the audacity to try to sue people who call him a white nationalist. So this is the thing, right? Deny, 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 yet put these ideas out, toxifying as they are, and yet deny that you are a neo-Nazi and white nationalist. It's time to call people what they are. But I think Steve Bannon is an incredibly dangerous character. You see all the executive orders that Trump is pushing through his first week. They're written in the language of Breitbart. The fact that Trump is saying he's going to publish crimes of immigrants. What does that sound like to you? It sounds like the homepage of Breitbart.com. So these are things that you see. Steve Bannon has been given unprecedented power. He not only is the chief strategist, he's now replaced the DNI head on the Security Council.
The Director of National Intelligence. Peter.
That's completely amazing when I read that and how the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're not invited every time. And the director of the CIA, I mean, it's like Steve Bannon has taken over national security for the United States of America, and they get to set out whatever agenda they have, which includes threatening the president of Mexico that they'll have to send troops down there if they can't take care of their bad guys. And we've already had an attack in Yemen where an 8-year-old girl was killed. So it's just an amazing thing. And now they're threatening Iran. It's terrifying.
Right out the gates, the first 2 weeks, you have Michael Flynn, psychotic Michael Flynn, who's salivating at the thought of war with Iran. Already, the Muslim ban, and by the way, it is a ban, and I'm free to talk about that as well. But all these people are like, oh, it's not a ban. Look, they've already entertained these ideas for years. Giuliani, the criminal of 9/11, even said on TV that Trump came to him, similarly that Bush did to John Yoo, and said, I want a Muslim ban. How do I make that legal? That's a fact. But Michael Flynn, right out the gates, you have Iran on a list, which is obviously a direct conversation with Iran. And then Michael Flynn coming out and saying, you're putting Iran on notice, like they're a 12-year-old child, putting them in the corner of the room. It is unbelievable what we're seeing within the first 2 weeks of Trump's presidency. And really, when you compare it to Obama's presidency, wow, how inept was that man? You could have come in there and done these sweeping measures with full control over Congress, and you just chose to sit on your hands. Great job, Obama. Well, guess what? These institutions are so fragile that they're being unraveled within days. Unbelievable.
Well, Abby Martin, talk a little bit more. You hinted at this, so talk a little bit more about the travel ban from these seven countries.
Right off the bat, none of the countries are any countries that have ever sponsored terrorism on American soil, that have killed any Americans. You're more likely to be killed by your clothes hanging in your closet than you are from a refugee. It's complete dog whistling, fear-mongering that has zero grounds in reality whatsoever. Trump, of course, whenever he does these sweeping broad measures that are extremely xenophobic, he always points to Obama, right? And a lot of times he's right when it comes to immigration. He's like, well, Obama deported more people than anyone else through. But when it comes to the Muslim ban, Obama never outright banned a country. He named these seven countries as danger zones, dangerous to travel. I'm sure there was vetting involved. And he did do a six-month quote-unquote extreme vetting process where he vetted visas from Iraqi refugees. This, on the other hand, is a outright across-the-board ban from seven countries affecting 130 million people. And at the very beginning, Steve Bannon overrode the DHS and everyone else in the government to include green card holders. The only reason that they're excluded now is because three federal judges actually deemed it completely unconstitutional and illegal. So this is the reality that we're dealing with now, is people were denied medical attention. People died. There was one woman who died trying to see her family. A child is badly burned, probably will die because he can't get medical attention. A woman was deported who was a professor. It is very disturbing, and it was rolled out with such haste and no thought whatsoever that people were simply on planes having no idea what their status was and were sent back to their countries. And what my theory is that Steve Bannon was trying to push the limits of how far he could go. And that's a really scary thought.
Well, Abby Martin, it reminds me of a quote. It was attributed eventually to Karl Rove in the Bush White House, W. Bush White House, a book by Ron Suskind. There's a passage of it here. It says, the aide said that guys like me, journalists, right, in what we call the reality-based community, in which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from judicious study of discernible reality. The shootback from Rove is, that's not the way the world really works anymore, he continues. And Rove says, we're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating another new reality, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, journalists, all of you will be left to just study what we do, or in real time as mere stenographers. Do you see any of that at work potentially with Bannon and Trump wheeling out so many executive orders and so many things that they clearly know will cause great tumult and great reaction while they're already two steps ahead with the next agenda?
Absolutely. When they're pushing forward Orwellian propaganda, and look, this didn't start with Trump, but it definitely is being mastered by Trump and Bannon. When you're putting out statements that, and denying facts and say that they're simply alternative facts that bolster your worldview, that's psychotic Orwellian behavior. And that reality thing, look, the Trump administration is already putting the Bush administration to shame. Bush's oil ties are a joke. We have the CEO of ExxonMobil in the White House right now, running foreign policy. Like, Steve Bannon has said in the past, fighting is good, anger is good, fear is good. He said Satan, Darth Vader, and Dick Cheney, that's power. He knows exactly what he's doing. He wants to foment civil war. He wants to crush leftists. This is it, baby. Steve Bannon at the helm, he wants this. He wants people fighting in the streets. He wants blood and guts. He said this. We can't let these people define the narrative for us. We can't let these people be victorious. We need to build a united front to the fascism that we're seeing unravel and take over this country within mere days. And already those journalists who were covering the protests, the inauguration, they're already being charged with 10 years of felony riot charges. There's an insane repression already on the press that is ramping up day by day, you guys.
And they're trying to bring that 10-year charges for rioting in North Dakota. But were you encouraged by the airport protests?
I was incredibly encouraged by the protests. And they weren't Soros operated. It was tons of cardboard signs. I've never seen more people coming out with things to do. These lawyers have full-time jobs. They were out there volunteering their time. They were sitting out there days on end, day and night, setting up little makeshift stands to help these refugees in the airport. And I saw thousands-strong rallies in Alabama, Ohio. People are on our side. We can't let these people set the narrative and tell us what the truth is. We know what the truth is. We love each other. We're brothers and sisters. We will be here for each other. We're not going to let this stand. We're not going to let Islamophobia and xenophobia dictate what we do in this country and how we pursue these policies and how we fight back. And that gave me more hope than anything has in a really long time.
So, Abby Martin, could you tell us a little bit more about your work lately? We know, of course, from Media Roots and the work you've done partnering with us at Project Censored and the great roundtable discussions and things we held last fall for our anniversary with you and Mark Crispin Miller, Manar Mahawish, David Talbot. But what are you working on now, of course, with the Empire Files on Telesur?
Well, of course, I've been a longtime board member of Project Censored because I think that everyone needs to donate to Project Censored. It's definitely the most important research organization in the country. But in the vein, keeping that fight alive and bringing it to other venues, I've been doing a show called The Empire Files for Telesur. It's basically cataloging and chronicling all of the underreported stories from the eyes of the marginalized and oppressed, because as we know, the victors write history. They write the narratives for us. And so we're retelling, we're recapturing what history really did and shows us and how we can use it to fight for a better future. And we cover everything from Native American rights to oil giants, to really analyzing what the empire does to affect the people in this country and around the world. And I also have an ongoing podcast on Media Roots, Media Roots Radio with my brother. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. So everyone check it out, vampirefiles.tv and Empire Files on YouTube.
Abby Martin, thanks so much for all of your important work. It's vital, and I believe it's more important now than ever here as we are rolling through the 21st century into the Trump-Bannon era. So thanks again for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, you guys. Really great talking to you.
After this brief musical break, we'll be joined by whistleblowing journalist and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson to continue our conversation on the state of our so-called free press. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our theme today talking about the state of our so-called free press and media issues in an era of so-called fake news. We're joined right now by Christina Borgeson. She's an internationally acclaimed journalist. She's also a whistleblower in the field of journalism. She's an investigative reporter and media critic. Christina Borgeson has also put together several book projects. She was the editor of Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, and Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out. Christina Borgeson also wrote the introduction to Censored 2011 and is also a documentary filmmaker. Christina Borgeson, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
My pleasure, Mickey.
Christina, again, it's great to have you on the program, and let's dive right in to the state of our so-called free press early on here in the Trump administration and riffing on these themes and terms that have come out of the last year. We're now seeing the President of the United States wield weaponized language like fake news at institutions like CNN.
The whole fake news moniker is very interesting to me because it really is, to my mind, code for blowback. You know, blowback against the networks and the major press outlets that on a number of issues, key issues, for years and years, for decades, have been putting out basically incorrect news or news that they're fed by official source. You know, they've been putting out the official source reporting. So fake news is sort of code for official source reporting that's not true. And it's really come back to bite the press in a very, very big way now. And so now we have the muddiest information environment of all. I mean, it's just fake news over here, propaganda over there, PR over here. People don't know what to believe, but I think Trump, it's in a very weird and perverted way, I think that Trump did perform a service. I can still remember the first time all those presidential candidates were up there for their first debate. And at some point, he turned around and he said, you know, I've paid all of you. I've given money to all of you. And when I give money for something, I expect something back. And it's almost like he broke that spell where even if the reporters would say that our politicians were bought off or whatever, here's a guy running for president who actually said it. And so he's got this sort of Tourette syndrome of reaching out and attacking. Of course, he lies. But my point to you is that he really has sort of lifted the veil on what a dirty, down low, full of falsehood information environment we live in, and how the press has contributed to that mightily. So in that sense, I think it's kind of weird and perverse, but he's provided a service, and people are looking to other places to get information.
It's interesting to me that you're saying blowback around the term fake news, in that certainly for a couple of generations now, public support and belief in corporate media has been in decline. But it's turned into sort of crisis entertainment news. And following CNN during the campaign, I mean, Trump was on every day. And so he got an enormous amount of attention, way and above all the other candidates, and certainly played on that. And
yeah.
Now his attack on the media, the New York Times will say he's a liar, but most of the other ones won't. NPR won't say that. They'll say, well, maybe he's just misinformed or something. You know, he doesn't really mean to lie. I think that he just says whatever he wants to say.
The press has always given a pass to the powerful. As a matter of fact, in my book, Feet to the Fire, I'm trying to remember who it was that I interviewed who said the New York Times had a policy of when a politician lied about a matter of policy, you did not say he lied. You say he misspoke. You could say he lied if he was talking about something private or personal. So it's not just Trump who was given a pass. And the reason why Trump got so much coverage was because he was more entertaining. The coverage has now been fully exposed. And I am giving Trump some credit for that. Because even though people knew that the press often misinformed through official source reporting, you'd still hear people say, well, you know, on CNN they said this. On one hand, they'd say, oh, you can't believe the press. And then they would say, oh, well, on CNN. So there were almost like two minds, and they were just going back and forth and back and forth. And now I think the attitude towards the press has really hardened.
And there have been many reactions to this, right? All of a sudden, we've seen, well, we need to talk to Facebook. It's this whole outbreak of fake news is because of social media, and Google needs to step in. And you know, what we've been saying here at Project Censored, these other outlets are talking about censorship or proper not or blacklists. What's wrong with good old-fashioned critical media literacy education, critical thinking skills? Education is really a core feature here. And in fact, there are several states, including California now, that are working on bills to really build a critical media literacy education infrastructure because the United States has long lacked one.
I think in the best of all possible worlds, that's fantastic. I think, first of all, our educational system does need to teach people critical thinking, because if people could think logically and critically, they just wouldn't buy a lot of the stuff that they see put out. They would see that there was no context in the reporting, no history, no context, and they would see when the information would go from it's black to it's white, and they would respond to that. So I think that's wonderful. But what you have right now is this highly reptilian war that is being waged for the minds of the American people. You've got all these government agencies that are doing it, the CIA, the FBI, the White House, the State Department, and then you've got the press, and you've got the press handmaiding government agencies as well as putting stuff out for their own agendas. So, I mean, it's so awful. And what's emerging now as the only press you can believe, and it's not even a press. Do you want to call WikiLeaks the press? It's now the world of real news, real investigation, is now the purview of whistleblowers and hackers.
And they've been ritually demonized, persecuted, and prosecuted.
Well, of course, because they're threatening the system.
Shooting the messenger is exactly what's happening, like with Gary Webb, who was very seriously targeted. And, of course, you have in your books, Into the Buzzsaw, in particular, you have a roster of amazingly courageous journalists telling the stories of how they were silenced or lost jobs. You yourself have seen that personally.
It's happened to me on several occasions. This is something that has been going on for a very long time, but I think it's hitting critical mass now. I mean, I'm reminded of the Pentagon Papers and Ellsberg. Because Ellsberg had the cojones to put out those papers, he shortened the Vietnam War at a time when Nixon was looking to expand the war. And there is a video of Nixon talking to returning POWs. The first thing he talks to them about is how secrecy is very important. And he tells them what happened with Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers is a travesty. He just reviled him. And then he talks about how everybody's home when, of course, POWs were left behind. So he does two things. First, he lies about the POWs, and then he tells them how secrecy is important, even though the exposure of the Pentagon Papers is what got those POWs out earlier. And at the end of this spiel, the POWs stand up and they clap for 5 minutes. It's such a stunning moment because you realize that these people are completely in the dark. Nobody has made that connection for them. And that is what the press is supposed to do.
We're speaking with journalist and author and documentary filmmaker Christina Borgeson. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the state of our so-called free press. Christina, we were talking about whistleblowers, the importance of whistleblowers. Before that, you had mentioned a little bit about the networks and certainly how much really kind of superficial and infotainment-like coverage was being given to Trump during the campaign. In fact, Les Moonves over at CBS, the chairman of the board, actually said that the Trump coverage led to increased profits. And he said, I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, he says. It's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS.
Right. And that's the thing. I think that responsible reporters, reporters who are not part of this system that is actually dying, I think that one of the things that we have to do is think about subjects to cover that help people disengage from these institutions that are really killing them financially and every other way. There are two main things, I think, that really affect people, and that is money and energy. People do not understand how banking works. They do not understand what alternatives there are, although the millennials, of course, are creating alternatives through Bitcoin, and they're creating alternatives to other things like hotels and stuff through Airbnb. They're creating people-to-people businesses that are starting to, like Uber, that are starting to sort of bring down these centralized institutions, and they're feeling threatened. But I really think that there's a whole area of reporting that needs to focus on these areas and also on renewable, sustainable energy. And I know it sounds kind of kumbaya or whatever, but imagine if you leached all the money out of those banks and started alternative ways of exchanging goods and services and so on and so forth, so that those banks could not control everybody the way they do. And the millennials have already started doing it. A lot of millennials do not have credit cards. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done, yes, in critical media viewing and media literacy. I think that's a real bottom line. But that's also a bottom line issue for our educational system. We have to teach our kids how to think, because if they can think logically, then they can see where they're being screwed. And a lot of these millennials are, as I say, are already starting to pull out of this. And I also think that to do that is to give people hope and to give people a direction that they can go in and act to make their lives better. I really think we have to focus on the more positive aspects of dealing with where we are now.
Christina, in all of my classes, I require students to subscribe to independent news sources and report back each week a news story that they thought was interesting. And part of our analysis, of course, is trying to put some of these stories together in a broader context. But we talk about what we really need to coverage now. I mean, certainly people in Black Lives would say we need to cover police killings holistically, not just somebody was shot in Minneapolis today and someone else, a mentally ill person, was shot in San Diego, but looking at it overall, this month the police killed 150 people, and that's 782 for the year so far. That kind of coverage, and then also the wealth concentration. And certainly Trump's cabinet is reflective of that with billionaires and generals, but the continuing concentration of wealth and the continuing decline of most working people in this country and worldwide. Those are the kinds of stories that need to be repeated and continue to be talked about. We don't get that from corporate media. They're in the entertainment business. But we can get that from independent news sources and Truth Dig and Truth Out and Global Report and all of these, Common Dreams, all are very important sources for that continue to have these kinds of themes.
I agree, but people have to know what to do with their resources so they don't feed into this thing. The whole Black Lives Matter, police brutality, the wars that we're waging all over the, you know, people talk, they talk about terrorism, you know, the coverage of terrorism never ever goes back to the history of our intervention in these countries. So everybody's kind of crazed in a sense. There, people are angry, they're poor, they're hungry, and they're violent as a result. I mean, violence is attached, we know, to poverty. There also has to be a change in headspace in terms of how people consider themselves as individuals. We need a humanocracy. We need people who think about themselves and everybody else as much as themselves. These are sort of more fundamental philosophical things, I guess. It sounds like it to me, but I think the millennials are moving to make it more concrete through their people-to-people businesses, you know, person-to-person exchanges for all kinds of goods and services. And my point to you is, I think that these are important things to focus on because the violence and the anger and the nastiness, it comes straight from the leadership on down. Maybe I sound like I'm coming out of left field to you guys. Again, the coverage of all of these things, the violence, the police violence against black folks, what's going on in South Dakota, the wars in the Middle East, the endless wars, you know, and the poverty that's going. And people think, oh, yes, poor people voted for Trump because, you know, they like Trump. And I don't think that's the case at all.
The neoliberal establishment has done very little for those groups other than negatively.
They've done nothing. And every administration that comes in continues to do nothing and continues to hand out the money. Every time there's a crash, banks have robbed people twice.
The road has been paved by neoliberalism from the Clintons through the Bushes through the Obamas, now back again. And now Trump is a more reactionary iteration of what we see going on. But a lot of this stuff has been coming down the pike for a long time. The corporate news media midwifed it. Sometimes they actively cheerled and promoted it. We can't be terribly surprised here, I think. But one of the solutions moving forward, I think, has to involve a restructuring of a people's media.
There is a media emerging. It's more than emerging. It's becoming quite a force. Assange is a perfect example of how much of a force it is. And these people, people like Assange, they don't just have the power, just like some of these activists, they don't just have the power to expose things. They have the power to do something about it. They can create consequences for people. If you look at what happened when PayPal decided that they were going to continue allowing the KKK to collect money, but they shut down WikiLeaks, some hacktivists went in there and said, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to pay for that. So there's a game afoot or a movement afoot that is giving an exponential boost to this people's press that you're talking about.
And Christina Borgeson, this fifth estate, the whistleblowers, the leakers, the hacktivists, a sixth estate coming on board is crowd-contested media and a new startup called Tribeworthy that we've been consulting with, creating trusted news using critical media literacy, using fallacies, you know, using things that are out there on platforms that millennials are using, right? So this is a positive thing. And what I wanted to do just to wrap with you here now is can you tell us a little bit about, because you're always working on so many things, books and movies and everything. And I know you have new things coming. Can you tell us a little bit about your next projects?
I have been for many, many years trying to come up with a major ongoing platform for whistleblowers, looking at their issues, looking at their lives, ongoing coverage of the issues, ongoing coverage of any problems or challenges that they face as a result of what they've done, et cetera, et cetera. And I just may be successful in that.
Well, Christina Borgeson, we'll certainly reach out to you and reconnect when that time is right, and we certainly want to hear more about it. So thank you so much for all of your work, your whistleblowing, your intrepid journalism, and we look forward to talking to you in the near future.
Thanks so much, Mickey.
Okay, thanks, Christina Borgeson. Up next on the Project Censored Show, we're going to be talking about the State of Power 2017, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are joined also by senior correspondent for the program, Michael Levitin. In this segment of the show, we are going to be looking at a new study and new article done on the State of Power 2017, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex by Justin Schlossberg. And this is from the Transnational Institute. And Michael Levitin, please introduce our guest.
Justin Schlossberg is a media activist, researcher, and lecturer at University of London. He's chair of the Media Reform Coalition, and his latest book is Media Ownership and Agenda Control. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
You go over a lot of points in this essay, as well as in the infograph that you participated, that you contributed to, called Manufactured Consent. We want to talk about both of those today. But starting with the essay, the Media Technology Military Industrial Complex. It's a mouthful, and most people would say they're familiar with the military industrial complex. You throw media and technology on the top of that. What do you want to say as your overarching theme with this?
Just that communications and the technology industries have always been central to the concept of a military-industrial complex, at least as Eisenhower first coined it and people like C. Wright Mills later talked about it. But I think the role played by the communications and technology sector today within that power elite is all the more significant.
Obviously, the era of Edward Snowden and the degree of information and the amount of sharing between technology companies and our military and our surveillance state, that clearly touched a chord globally, not least here in America, raising our awareness of the degree to which our media companies and these companies that kind of have their nice friendly appearance and role in our lives are actually quite interwoven in the government apparatus and the ability to surveil and potentially ultimately control what we do as citizens. What connections have you drawn focusing on Google and Facebook and the fact that 70% of news readers now come from those two sources alone? What are some of the connections you draw?
Well, I guess I'm looking at it from two perspectives, really. The first is, and you touched on this because it was largely revealed by the Snowden leaks, the fundamental interdependence between what many people are calling the platform monopolies and the state, and particularly the military and security state. And that really underlines not just what was in the Snowden leaks, but also what we've seen happen since with the kind of very public furor between Silicon Valley and the U.S. government. But really what that belies is the ongoing, very intimate cooperation and collaboration over what we could label blanket public surveillance programs. And you see that in the kind of local state level as well as the federal level. So that's kind of one aspect of it. And the other aspect is the fundamental interdependence between the platform monopolies or the intermediaries and the actual owners and producers of news content, the people that were once described as the news gatekeepers and the kind of really, you know, in radical liberal critique, the greatest threats to well-functioning democracies. But actually, again, what we see is a kind of surface rhetoric of conflict and even legal battles over things like ancillary copyright. Yet underneath that, there is very strong evidence of growing alliance and interdependence from everything in the way that algorithms work to promote and prioritize mostly mainstream dominant news brands to the actual deals that are being made. I mean, it would things like Facebook's instant articles. These are not sectors that are in protracted conflict, as many people believe. And it's certainly not the case that the new media gatekeepers are usurping power from traditional media owners and editors. They're working much more in concert.
Justin Schlossberg, Mickey Huff here. One of the top stories in our last book, Censored 2017, was on search engine algorithms, and it also looked at electronic voting machines and technology and how that could swing the 2016 election in the United States. But it did talk about search engine algorithms, and that's certainly something that you're writing about, a tyranny of algorithms. What do you see as a possible effect or outcome in terms of this kind of technology and the idea of manufacturing consent?
Well, I think part of the problem, one of the greatest obstacles to kind of understanding the complexities of this power is just getting through that apparent conflict and disconnect. The reality is we're living in a time where the buzzword is fake news, and that's attributed more often than not to the kind of niche emergent alternative news providers and voices that are supposedly being promoted by news algorithms like Google's, in kind of deference to the long tail of internet diversity, and that this is seen as now the great problem because the established CNNs and BBCs of the world no longer have this kind of authoritative voice and no longer able to provide a check on kind of fake or erroneous information. And that's, in my view anyway, almost exactly the opposite of what's happening in practice. The reality is that it is mostly the mainstream brands, mainstream news providers, both in the commercial and the public service sector, that are amplifying fake news more often than not and providing an echo chamber for it. So the problem really is not the way that Google is promoting sort of fringe alternative news voices. It's quite the opposite, actually. If you look at the way Google's news algorithm pattern has developed, it's very much in favor of promoting the likes of CNN and BBC. In fact, in Google's latest patent, they actually say explicitly that they don't consider hometown or local news sources to be as intrinsically as reliable as the likes of the CNN and BBC. That's the real problem, because we're almost kind of confronted by this doublespeak.
Justin, this is Peter Phillips. I'm looking at your 10 biggest media companies and the board interlocks, and this is something at Project Censored that we've observed and researched over the years for a long time. What we added to this element, though, is the idea that the big public relation firms, and we call them public relations and propaganda firms, WPP, Omnicom, and Interpublic Group, they're the largest, and they have hundreds of thousands of employees in thousands of offices all over the world, and they are creating literally fake news. Now, their history is advertising for products, but they now work for the Pentagon, the State Department, the military organizations, the World Economic Forum. They are spinning and planning the news, and corporate media runs this as content. So we know that about two-thirds or better of all stories are originating in one of these public relations firms.
Absolutely. And this has been researched and documented quite well in the UK and Europe and in the US over a number of years, that the growth and rise of the public relations industry and its centrality within centres of power of all description is very much undermining journalism and journalism's ability to hold power to account, to fulfill its supposedly unique contribution to democratic life. You just can't do that when most people who are actively employed in the communications field are employed to do public relations rather than journalism. And part of the problem is that the distinction between the two is becoming increasingly blurred. And so there are many people now who are in communications roles, whether it's in an actual public relations firm, or there are increasingly law firms now that effectively do public relations work. They often don't see themselves as being the masters of spin.
And Justin, I think you could also add to that, as your infograph does on Transnational Institute, the think tanks that generate the political and the legislative kind of ideas, like you cited, you know, Wilbur Ross, who is tapped to be the Commerce Secretary under Trump, he was tapped by the Brookings Institute, by Brookings, as someone who should be in the Trump administration, and that's how he kind of arrives there, or the Heritage Foundation of four key staffers on the Trump transition team from there. That also plays into it. I want to say, though, that the idea that Google, at the same time that we're talking about them, that they spent $2.2 million on the 2016 elections, most of that to Republican candidates, that is certainly a new phase entering.
It's not necessarily a reflection of the fact that Google secretly favors the Republican Party. I mean, I think for better or for worse, I think most of big tech hedged their bets with Hillary, and they were caught a little bit unstuck. They're coming out of an administration that's been really a complete love-in with Silicon Valley. And the revolving door has been spinning at all levels of government, and, you know, especially Google Federal, but also Facebook and others. And Obama's approach was simply to roll out the red carpet and do whatever that they say. There is obviously some concern that Trump wouldn't be as amenable, but I think the donation to the candidates, and also the fact that virtually all of Silicon Valley took up Trump's invitation to go and sit around the table at Trump Tower whilst he was president-elect, I think that, again, just indicates how deeply embedded the technology world is with the state, how deeply interdependent they are. And I think Trump's words were at the meeting, you know, anything you want, just give me a call. And that's a continuation, not a break with successive administrations' policy.
Right. And Justin Schlossberg, I'm afraid we're out of time for this segment, but could you please give a website so people can go and read the study and learn more online?
I would recommend the website of the organization I represent, which is mediareform.org.uk, which has all manner of articles and resources very much related to that.
And TNI.org also has these studies, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us. We definitely want to have you back on the program soon to get into more detail. This is certainly something that we very much have in common with you. So we're delighted to have made the connection, and special thanks to Michael Levitin.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why
that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Thank you for joining us today. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Also, come visit and see what we do online at www.projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Capitalism's Apocalypse. Why the Rich Can't Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves. Parenti gave this talk on August 23, 2008, in Oakland, California. He predicted the financial crisis that began only weeks later when he said that giant corporate capitalism, by its very nature, is an apocalyptic system. When left to its own devices and unregulated, the built-in elements of ever-increased growth may well bring the whole system down, Parenti said. And he described the growing national debt not as a tragic mistake, but as a means to shift ever more money from the taxpayers to the financial institutions. The speech that you are about to hear is an analysis of the many structural flaws of a capitalist system that puts it on a permanent collision course with democracy. Here is Michael Parenti.
First off, I think we should notice that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy. It's an antagonistic relationship. Historically, capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They opposed, in this country, every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and for office holding. They oppose it with tooth and fang and claw and nail. They oppose the freedoms of an independent press and the strong dissident voices that emerge. They opposed mass demonstrations of dissent. They opposed the right to collective bargaining, the right to public education for all, which would be a basic condition for democracy, for citizenry. They opposed that. They fought against it for generations. They opposed the living wage and safe work conditions, which is a democratic condition. They opposed direct elections of office holders in many cases, even to today. Today, they oppose the direct election of the president. They're sticking with the Electoral College, which, of course, favors these small states, giving them a very loaded additional vote. And those small states usually go Republican, the red states. They opposed more equitable and more democratic modes of representation. They oppose proportional representation. They've gotten a good deal of proportional representation undone in Italy, getting rid of then the whole multi-party social democracy, and so you've got these two left-of-center, right-of-center parties, and it begins to resemble the American alignment in terms of how politics go. They oppose easy access to the ballot. Today, as you see, conservatives, staunch warriors of capitalism, are passing laws in states like Missouri which require proof of birth. There was that case of the one woman who was 85, 86, who had been voting for, you know, for half a century or more, and who now suddenly had to write to Mississippi to get her birth certificate, and there was no record of it. So she's being disfranchised by these laws. It is their goal to disfranchise, to limit, to constrict, to undermine, to dilute democracy, while keeping certain democratic forms, because those forms legitimate the system and they convince people that they're free and they're self-selecting in their rulers. So we should keep in mind that capitalists, historically speaking, have had a near impossible time trying to act democratic. They often cannot even abide by their own constitution. I mean, it's their constitution. It's not all that democratic. It's full of all sorts of little rigs and snares and whatever else. So to defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, they must act unfairly, undemocratically, and unconstitutionally, using force and violence, deception and manipulation. You know, Eugene Victor Debs, the great American labor leader we know, socialist, he became aware of some of this when he was thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people. I mean, there he was, you know, if you ever been roughed up and thrown in jail, you have time in jail, you could feel the bruise or the cop hit me here, oh, it hit me here, oh. And so you're sitting there and you're feeling your aches and knocks. I speak from experience on two occasions. And it really gets you thinking about the democracy that you live in. You know, you say, Jesus, what a democracy. God, thank God for American democracy. Debs, thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people, he came to the conclusion that the state was not a neutral arbiter. That's funny. Well, here's a dispute between two private interests, capital and labor, the owners of this factory and the people who work in the factory. There's two private interests. Why does the state come down so heavily on the side of one particular private interest? Why does it come down on the side of capital at such a cost to labor and with such brutality? So Debs came to the realization, as just a regular trade union leader who was trying to organize unions to get people a little more pay, better pay and all that, Debs come to the conclusion that capitalism was not just an economic system, but it was a whole social order that rigged the rules in its favor. And with that realization, of course, he was transforming himself from a labor leader to a socialist leader. Well, still being a labor leader, they're not mutually exclusive, of course. Now, while uneasy with democracy, while fearful of democracy, the capitalist class and their spokespersons and such make a big play about claiming democracy as their invention. They claim to be its progenitors, even as they subvert it, not only at home, but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist states have undermined, attacked, and destroyed political reform movements and revolutionary movements in countries throughout South America, Central America, Africa, the Middle East. And I'm talking about the Middle East, where we never think, oh, there's no democracy, and this phony president waged the war on Iraq to teach them democracy. Well, the Iraqis had a democratic revolution back in 1958, you know. It was a wonderful thing, broad-based coalition with all sorts of groups, and it was slowly undermined and destroyed through violence and assassination and everything else. The leader of the counter-revolutionary movement was a guy who was trained, equipped, advised, and backed by the CIA. His name was Saddam Hussein. You never hear about it. Whenever they talk about Saddam Hussein over the last 5 years, they always start like he was born in 2001 or something, you know. So they resist democratization not only at home, but abroad. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is obviously to maintain and advance the interests of capital accumulation, to keep that whole process going. And that's the one we on the left usually focus on. There's another function, which nobody seems to talk about much. That's the function of protecting the capitalist system against the capitalists, saving capitalism from itself, because it is a self-devouring beast. It will eat everything in sight, and when there isn't anything else to eat, well, sometimes there may be, but then there's this other juicy thing that it sees, it can't resist, its own tail, and it starts to devour its own tail. There's a number of Latin American countries where you had near meltdowns. Brazil, remember that? I think Chile for a while. I mean, the most notably one in the late 90s was Argentina, where the whole thing went. That was a failure of the capitalist state to rein in the capitalists. They will go and they will plunder and they will pillage their own, if they can make a quick profit. If I could get the entire money stream that's going into this auto factory and walk away with $80 million, what the hell do I want the auto factory for? What do I care about that? I'm not interested in seeing that you get cars or refrigerators or food or clothing. I'm not in that business. I'm in the business of making a profit. Well, Argentina, it got so bad, you know what's happened since then. Workers started taking over these factories and businesses and refurbishing them and building them, said, who needs the bosses? What did the boss ever do? If we can just scrape together some capital in this net. I remember talking to my friend Horacio, who's an Argentinian. I said, and these bosses are coming back. They said, no, they're finished. They're out. Not true. They're coming back. Right now they're coming back claiming their property rights. Sure, they got a profitable business all again. They want to take it all over again and milk it and plunder it for all it's worth. We saw the same thing happening in the U.S. Charles Keating, he built Lincoln Savings and Loans. He built it of $200 million. You see, that's what it's about. Why bother making refrigerators? You got to get the costs, materials, deal with labor. Then you got to sell them, hope to make it back, realize your investment, isn't that? When you can just go and steal the money that's in there, just steal the money. He did. What did he get? 4 years in prison. Charles Keating did for $200 million. I know a lot of people. Don't raise your hand. Who would do four years if they can walk out then with $200 million? I think he had to give back 30 million. They never seem to have, I don't know where I put it all. I mean, here, I'll give you back something. But the point is, if everybody's behaving that way, the system as a system begins to collapse. So I, as the capitalist government, have to persuade you to not do that, you see. But if you've been doing that, you might even go to jail. Unless you're Vice President of the United States and President of the United States. And I do think probably that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Democrats recognize this second function. At least more Democrats recognize it. But they have a little bit more of a sense of trying to hold off the beast from devouring itself. Well, why go way, way back to Ken Lay? We can look right today. We may be facing a meltdown, the subprime hustling, the international bank run on the dollar. I mean, there is now an enormous debt, and you can't live on debt. Eventually, the whole system can collapse. Think Oh, What a Wonderful Life. Think of Jimmy Stewart in the bank, you know. Instead of a little town, think of the whole world doing that.
You're listening to the rebroadcast of a very contemporary-sounding talk by the author, lecturer, and activist, Michael Parenti. He spoke in August of 2008, predicting the financial crisis that began a few weeks later. Parenti had come to the reception of an art show in an Oakland, California gallery. It was a warm day, and the sounds of traffic on Broadway came in through the open windows. The title of his talk was Capitalism's Apocalypse: Why the Rich Can't Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves. That title went well with the theme of the exhibition of collages by me, Mariah Gallardon. That was Toasting the End of Capitalism. Martin Spencer Davis and I made an audio recording as well as a film on DVD. Back to Michael Parenti.
And besides that trade debt, we have a national debt. The national debt is the money that the government owes to citizenry, both Americans and foreigners. And that has grown. When George W. Bush took power, the national debt was $5 trillion. It's now, as of this January, it will be $10 trillion. He managed to double it. The conservatives have discovered that the national debt is a very wonderful way of dampening spending on human services. It's also a marvelous way of undermining the federal government's ability to perform any functions for us. And it's also a means of privatizing the federal budget. The greater chunk of this budget that goes to just servicing this debt, the less money you have for anything else. So what you're doing is every tax dollar you pay in, a larger and larger portion of it is simply being cut off and then put into the pockets of rich private creditors. So the government has for years now been borrowing money from the people they should be taxing, meanwhile cutting the taxes of those very same people so that they'll have even more money to borrow to the government. And all of this we pay for. We pay for that. That's the way the system goes. Now, giant corporate capitalism is, by its innate nature, its essence, an apocalyptic system. It is, when left purely to its own devices. The essence of capitalism is the transformation of living nature into commodities, and commodities into dead capital, into just so many numbers in the book. So capitalism, while it's doing that, while it's transforming living nature into dead capital, is also foisting its diseconomies and toxicities upon the general public and the natural environment. I remember years ago in 1971, when I was teaching at the University of Vermont, I announced that the environmental movement is potentially subversive of capitalism. And I remember a couple of colleagues saying, you're getting carried away and don't, where are you going with that, and blah, 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 that sort of thing. But I think it's true. And, you know, by the way, it's not true that the corporate class has ignored the environmental problem. Quite the contrary. They have vehemently and strenuously attacked it. They've attacked the environmental movement, calling them tree huggers and eco-Gestapo and this and that and all sorts of names like that. But Debs, getting back to Debs sitting in his cell, Eugene Victor Debs is sitting there, and he remarks that the extent to which life in an advanced industrial capitalist state, the extent to which it was bearable or decent or survivable, depended on the humanizing effects of democratic struggle. He was saying, I now see that the extent to which we could even bear this thing and even help it inadvertently, helping it to survive, is by trying to ameliorate its worst abuses and make certain changes so that we can breathe and live and find a little space where we can be human, you see. So we create little patches of community while this colossus keeps going on us. So that democratic struggle is part of the class struggle. That's what those struggles are about. That's what Debs was doing. He was doing class struggle. He was doing democratic struggle. He ended up, when he got out of jail, getting thrown back into jail by that great believer of democracy, Woodrow Wilson, for opposing World War I and saying this is a war that the working people of Europe and of America have no interest in, it's not something we should be fighting, and all that sort of thing. He went back to jail for that one. So that class struggle and democratic struggle imposes restrictions, it forces some reforms and has restraints. But that's about it. Well, is capitalism a successful system? I mean, they've been crowing, you know, ever since 1991, too, with the overthrow of the Soviet Union. They've been crowing about capitalism is the successful system, is the system that delivers the goods. It's brought us all this good life. Is it a successful system? I would argue yes and no, depending upon where. What is your position in the social order? You tend to see social reality according to the position you occupy in the social structure. And not only tend to see, it's not just a perceptual thing, it's also a actual material reality. Let's start with the capitalist leaders, those who are both state leaders, those who are rich, among the richest up there in that top fraction of 1%. It's not the top 1 or 2%. It's about 0.04 of 1% really, really owns the lion's share, most of what's going on. And they're the ones who make this enormous wealth. All right, George W. Bush is one of those people. And in August of 2008, which is still this month, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, came out with a statement. It's about time she actually said something confrontational and partisan. She said, George Bush is a failure in all of his policies. He's just a failure. I disagree. I think George Bush is a smashing success in almost every area. This massive debt that he's built up, you know, this massive increase in military budget, his ventures abroad, which have been very, war has been very good to George Bush, at least for a while it was. Now, that did backfire a little in terms of the polls and all that. The massive shift in the tax burden, that's massively been shifted from that top group, the undoing of the real estate tax, which they called the death tax, cutbacks and defunding of human services, including public education, environmental protections. He's been successful in all of that. He's not a total success. There's a couple of places he hasn't gotten through yet, Medicare and Social Security. So try, if you want to have a radical analysis and not just a liberal complaint, try to look at success the way the big money boys do. Capitalism is less than fully successful in countries like Norway, Finland, Denmark. Countries, you say, well, wait, they're very prosperous and all that. But capitalism is not interested in prosperity. It's interested in profits. Please don't confuse those two things. Okay, so that's where success lies. Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia. That's the model. That is the success. That's the success they're looking for. Remember that. So capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but also to prosperity. But that's not true, as I've just been saying. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. To the extent that there is prosperity, it's because of, as Debs thought of it in prison, it's because of our struggle to create a minimum wage law, child labor law, Social Security, better wages and such. But their goal is the opposite. It's really to create poverty, because the poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less. I mean, why is it you won't work for 18 cents an hour or 14 cents an hour the way the Indonesians do? Is it because we Americans are just so much more self-respecting? We wouldn't consider it? No, it's because we're at a stage of historical struggle where we don't have to. But that goal is to get us back to 1900, because in 1900 we did work for pennies an hour. A half a century before the term was invented, the U.S. was a third world country. It had widespread underemployment. It had tuberculosis epidemics in some of the major cities and typhoid epidemics and the like. It had all sorts of desperation, no public health, no public education, well, limited public education in some areas, only up to grade school and such. And that's what they're trying to get back to. Now, let me just say that the reactionaries in the Republican Party have enjoyed over the last 30 years a remarkable success. Back in 1978, and I got the quote in an essay I wrote, which appeared in one of my books. The book is out of print now, Land of Idols. It was a group of plutocrats meeting and coming out and saying, this has got to stop. I mean, giving word to Jimmy Carter, who was president at the time, this has got to stop. I mean, where's it going to end? You guys have got this gain, this, that, the other thing. We're going to end up being a social democracy. I found it fascinating that he used the term. Fast forward 30 years. There was an article recently, an article I clipped from the New Yorker, dealing with the question that the GOP is having problems, which is they're getting a shortage of issues. They don't quite know where to attack anymore. And as one of them said, you know, we've achieved our goal, which was to prevent the United States from becoming a social democracy. He used the term again. These guys know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. This is not an analysis I'm superimposing on it. It's what they themselves think about and work on. And they have scripted They have perfectly scripted and ideologized their approaches to things. So that's what we got to understand, the importance of ideology. And the fact is that their goal is to get us to Indonesia. Our goal at this historical stage, at least, is to get us to Denmark and then beyond. At least. Thank you so much for your kind attention.
That was the noted scholar, activist, and author Michael Parenti. This speech, Capitalism's Apocalypse, Why the Rich Can't Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves, was given only weeks before the financial crisis of 2008 began. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached large audiences in North America and abroad. You can find a huge archive of films and audio recordings of Parenti's speeches on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Parenti was recorded by Martin Spencer Davis in an Oakland, California art gallery on August 23, 2008. It was the closing reception for an exhibition of political collages by me, Mariah Gillarden. You can find out more about this program and see photos of the collages on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or a film of this talk on DVD, by mail, or credit card, by phone, or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Mariah Gillarden. Thank you for listening.
Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
To the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Well, we're finally back. I know you missed us terribly. This week, our guest is Father John Deere, and I'm sorry for the quality of the audio, but like John says, he's up in the mountains of New Mexico just trying to do the best he can. But John Deere is an internationally known voice for peace and nonviolence, a longtime activist, popular lecturer, and movement organizer. Father John is the author of 35 books and hundreds of articles, including Living Peace, Jesus the Rebel, and The Nonviolent Life. He was recently nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Stay tuned and we'll be right back with Father John Deere. Father John Deere from the desert in New Mexico, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. We recently reconnected when I was on a vacation in Hawaii, and you were there to speak at one of the universities, and it was just really nice to catch up with you, and I'd like to, tell my listeners what you're up to and what the exciting events that are happening coming up that you're helping to organize or involved in. But before we do that, tell my listeners a little bit, how did you get into all this peace stuff a long, long time ago?
Well, thanks, Cindy. Yes, it was great to see you in Hawaii. Well, I'm 58 now, and I was never planning all this. I was going to be a pious priest, Cindy, and as you see, that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. What happened, I was a kid, and I was about to enter the seminary, 21, and I thought, well, I'm going to spend the summer hitchhiking through the Holy Land to see where Jesus lived. Wasn't that a nice idea? Mm-hmm. Only the week I left, Israel invaded Lebanon.
Wow.
It was the summer war of 1982, and all the tour groups were canceled, and I was an oblivious, naive, dopey kid. I hitchhiked through Israel for months and was camping out for several weeks alone at the Sea of Galilee and meditating at the little chapel of the Beatitudes up in the North Shore, where the teachings of Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount were literally on the wall. Blessed are the peacemakers. Love your enemies. And it was there that I saw all these jets, massive jets, swoop down over the Sea of Galilee, breaking the sound barrier, setting off these sonic booms, and then dropping bombs 15 miles away at Lebanon. And it changed my life. I decided then and there that I would spend my life trying to practice and teach Jesus' teachings about peace and justice, love your enemies, which means the abolition of war. And I invite your listeners to really think about that, that I saw war at the place where the nonviolent Jesus said, you know, love, peace, universal nonviolence. And so I hit the ground running, Cindy. I was 21, and the next week I was with Daniel Berrigan and joined every peace group in the world. And, you know, in a couple of years, I was living in El Salvador in the war zone, in a refugee camp with the Jesuit priests who were all later assassinated. They were my friends.
Wow.
And that was a life-changing thing. And ever since, I've been I've been arrested 80 times and organized 1,000 demonstrations. I've written all these books and lecture on war. And I'm still trying to live out that promise. I had an unusual experience. That's what happened to me, Cindy. And but it was a great blessing, too, you know. And so here I am, still struggling to live out Jesus' teachings on peace and nonviolence in this terrible moment we're living through under Trump and all, you know, and the world of war.
Right. So, excuse me. Well, of course, the wars didn't go away when Obama was president. And in 2015, he dropped 26,000 bombs on the world. So I think since you, well, I mean, since way before we were born, this country has been violent. And it doesn't matter if there's a Democrat or Republican, the things we care about the most, they don't seem to change. But here, you say, you know, Trump is president. It seems like the Christian right is ascending, and it seems like the Christian right, they don't necessarily, and I'm not being judgmental, I'm just observing, they don't necessarily follow those teachings of Jesus as assiduously as you try to. And some of my other friends, like Father Louis Vitale and some nuns that, well, you know, we both know or we both know of, seem to really follow those teachings. And you recently were, I don't know, fired from your order, or what would you call it?
Well, so these are, I totally agree with you, your assessment. It's just a world addicted to war and greed and weapons and killing. And, so the peacemaker's life and what I got from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount then and now is a whole vision of a world of nonviolence. You call it the kingdom of God. It's so lovely. And it's just, we're just part of a movement from Jesus to Gandhi, you know, pursuing that new world. Well, the church for 1700 years has all been for war. They totally threw out the Sermon on the Mount, created a just war theory, has nothing to do with the gospel. And then when they have crusades in the Middle Ages led by the cardinals going off and killing millions of Muslims, you know, the church priests owning slaves, burning women at the stake, that could go on and on. And we see it now in what you call the Christian right. And, we have completely rejected Jesus' vision of nonviolence. But what is, and that's my experience, you know, that I was a Jesuit for 32 years, and I have been in trouble my entire life for talking about nonviolence and working to end war, and banned by 100 bishops from giving talks about Jesus and peace, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount. But I haven't stopped me because I read, well, they killed Jesus, so this is part of the job description. You know, you're going to get in trouble. If you work for peace in a world of total war, you're going to get in trouble. You're not going to win the Nobel Prize, you know, and everyone's saying you're great. No, it's hard. And so I'm not surprised at anything, but especially under Bush's war in Iraq, I was speaking to huge crowds across the country, and the complaints were going to the Vatican. So I was banned by the Jesuits for working for peace anymore, and I was sent to, literally punished, put in a house in Baltimore. Meanwhile, the Jesuits had a priest working at Los Alamos in full security at the labs. The Jesuits had a chaplain at Abu Ghraib ministering to the torturers. Meanwhile, the Jesuits in Baltimore were having an annual mass for war, where the ROTC cadets were professing their oath to kill to uphold the Constitution in front of the Blessed Sacrament. Now, that's what Hitler did. And I just decided to speak about this publicly. You know, just as you'd speak about against the sex abuse scandal and say no, and no to sexism, and you need to say no to the church and the Jesuits' complicity with the culture of war. Well, the Jesuits are running 28 universities and getting hundreds of millions of dollars from the Pentagon. So they have to shut me up, you know?
Right.
So what happened was when I realized they finally got me, I left. I was punished, but I left. And then a bishop in California said, no, you have to stay a priest and keep speaking out. We don't have anybody in the country. So I'm a priest in good standing with the Diocese of Monterey, California, and I continue to travel the world and organize. And maybe I could say a word about what we're doing with Pope Francis.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Please do.
Well, the thing is, we had a great conference. The Vatican asked us to help draft the Pope's World Day of Peace message, which some of us did. It came out January 1st. It's called Nonviolence. It's the first statement of violence in the history of the Catholic Church. King. And now we're working with the Pope and the Vatican to get to write an encyclical on nonviolence, which means actually getting rid of the just war theory. And that'll change church history if this happens. And if the Pope survives, you know, I'm very hopeful that this is going to happen in 2 to 3 years. We're working very closely now with really good people in the Vatican. And I think locations with the rest of the church, if this happens, will be very powerful in a lot of other ways. And it's a sign of hope on the world that Pope Francis is open now to complete war. And what does that mean for the church? And it would affect all the other religions, too, if Pope Francis does this. That gives me hope, and I hope it would give your listeners hope.
John, let's address the controversy about Pope Francis when he was, I think, cardinal in Argentina, and it seemed like he appeared to support the dictatorship.
So this was in the 1970s, long before he was a cardinal.
Oh, I thought he was cardinal. I'm sorry.
No, it was worse. He was a Jesuit provincial. Just mean Jesuit provincials that I suffered under in the United States who supported war. In the 1970s in Buenos Aires, during the Dirty War, which 30,000 people killed, and I mean, the worst thing he did was imagine two young Jesuit seminarians, just like me, who were activists working against the war. He turned them into the junta. And they were arrested and tortured because of him as a Jesuit priest. Now, one of them later died, and the other is still alive. Well, then by the 80s and 90s, he becomes the cardinal of Buenos Aires. And one who survived went and spent a weekend with him. And Francis, in effect, had a conversion, kind of like Oscar Romero.
Right.
And he's realized Francis was a terrible person. And I think everyone has awareness of what he was like, which was a typical church, bishop, provincial. And he is fighting that tooth and nail not to be like that and trying to get the bishops and priests to change and even going so far as working with us on an encyclical on nonviolence. So this is a good thing, and people don't understand his transformation, and he's very up now. This is what's happening with him and why he's trying to be so good.
Thank you, John, for clearing that up about Pope Francis. I think it's important that we address that and get that out of the way. But talk about your 18-month initiative, the Campaign Nonviolence, and how my listeners can become involved.
Great. Well, my friends and I organized this project called Campaign Nonviolence, and we're in our fourth year. And one of the things is we call for a national week of actions every September, around September 21st, International Peace. And so we're asking for public marches and demonstrations against the whole culture of violence. We call it connecting the dots against weapons, racism, and therefore poverty and greed, and nuclear weapons and environmental destruction. But for the coming of a new culture of peace and nonviolence, as Martin Luther King envisioned it. And last year we had 758 demonstrations against the whole spectrum of violence and for a culture of nonviolence, covering all 50 states. This September, we hope to have over 1,000. We already have over 400 registered on our website, campaignnonviolence.org. Well, what we are urging people is to really dig in revolutionary nonviolence, especially over the next 18 months, just as an organizing tool. That's kind of what it is, Cindy, to help build the movement. I know a lot of people are working, and Bill McKibben said last week, from now on, weekends are for protest. I thought that was great. Spain, every Saturday, we are trying to have a coordinated week of action in September. And then next spring, we're asking for people to have retreats and organizing weekends and workshops on nonviolence. We're asking people to double up in nonviolence trainings in their cities around the country. And then next September, we want to have thousands of people in thousands of actions in the streets, September 2018, and we're going to have a national event in a spirit in Washington, D.C. We will probably march from Dr. King's statue to the White House and do nonviolent direct action, only probably in silence, and maybe even ask people to wear white like Gandhi did and suffragettes did 100 years ago in 1918. They were marching. They were really brave. So we're just, and I know it's about the congressional elections, but of course it's much bigger than that, as you were saying, to advocate a different world without war, world without weapons and starvation and racism. So I hope people can go to the website, campaignnonviolence.org, organize an event in their community in September, and we have a lot of other good projects and programs, and they can contact me through the website if they want to bring me in to speak or have questions about organizing.
Nice. Great. You have, by the way, you have an amazing website. John, is it johndeere.com?
johndeere.org. Yeah.
.org. It's really awesome.
Some young Jesuit who was working with gang kids in Camden, New Jersey, in the year 2000, organized. He got them off the streets, trained to set up websites before anybody was doing this. And he said, "Well, we need a prototype." And they said, "Well, we'll get John. He'll do anything." And so he set up the state of the art website for me in 2000, and it's still going. And it has all my writings, my speaking schedule, and lots of information, my books. I have a new book out called The Beatitudes of Peace, which explores, I unpack the Sermon on the Mount, and has a lot of diaries and experiences I've had in jail. Yeah, I hope people can look at that too, johndeere.org, campaignnonviolence.org.
How long,
yeah, that's kind of my
list. How many times have you been in jail?
I've been in and out of my whole life since 1984. I was arrested, and so I've probably spent over a year in jail, if you add it up. I, with Philip Berrigan, did a progress action where we walked onto the Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Cindy, we walked through 10,000 soldiers up to one of 75 F-15 fighter bombers with nuclear weapons. And we hammered on the side of it. I hammered once, and I faced 20 years in prison for that.
Wow.
Ours was the 50th of about 100 plowshares actions. Now, this is from Isaiah, written 3 years ago. Someday people will come along and beat their swords into plowshares and study war no more. And the Berrigans launched this movement. And he did. In a tiny cell with Phil, and I never left the cell. But I can't ever vote again. I'm highly monitored. But we have a campaign now here in New Mexico, campaign at Los Alamos, calling for the closing of the labs and the destruction of nuclear weapons. And I around the week of Trump's inauguration with a lot of friends. Anti-death penalty movement. And we had a horrible couple of days in jail, and Cheney gave me 50 hours of service. So I've been working in kitchen and shelter in Santa Fe, but I go back before the judge in August in D.C., and he still might put me in prison for a couple months because I have a long record.
Right.
And I just learned that this is part of life. You know, in the United States, you resist, and not everybody has to cross the line, but some people should, and certainly a priest should. You know, I just thought it's what a description, and I can.
Well, John, I'm losing you again. This is gonna be a good place to end the conversation, I think. But John Deere for Campaign Nonviolence and johndeere.org. Thank you for your lifelong work for peace and for keeping going. And we'll post those links on the soapbox so people can go to it and hopefully join Campaign Nonviolence and just get something started for peace.
Thank you so much, Cindy, and all the best to you and all your listeners. Let's just keep working for peace no matter what.
Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to go further with the subject and further with your activism. Please go to johndeere.org. He really does have a great website, and you can find out everything he's involved in and get more information about his campaign for nonviolence and his campaign to make the Catholic Church finally recognize that there's no such thing as a just war. And I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and Father John Deere for doing this interview. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.